Soon, cells will be precisely programmed.
Viruses can be reprogrammed. They're essentially software. Think of them as apps for your cell phone.
And coding with DNA will no longer be just for expensive laboratories, but also for home use.
Come check out where CRISPR kits are being made.
It is obvious that governments have to play a leading role in securing cybersecurity, but ultimately, cybersecurity is a challenge for all of us. It is important to use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect on the lessons the cybersecurity community can draw and improve our preparedness for a potential cyber pandemic.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me today. Wearing my Truth Matters shirt, ready to cut right to the chase today. There's a lot to get to today of three big topics that were really kind of blending into one, and you'll see why. Very, very important stuff here. Things that we've talked about, I mean, I can't even count them how many times we've probably talked about each one of these discussions. Well, first of all, what you saw there in the opening was Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum, even with that supposed fake news conspiracy theory thing on the wall right next to him where it says the Great Reset. Not real, though, according to mainstream media. But he's sitting there talking about the idea of a cyber pandemic. And that doesn't seem to make sense to most people unless you try to lean into what they want you to see it as. Is kind of, oh, it's an analogy, right? It's like our body, like as Whitney says, our body's now the battlefield. Weird, blending right in with their own analogy. But it's more than that. And you'll see why when we get into this concept of what the blending of these, you know, the cyber attack, the pandemic idea that it's sort of like a virus for your computer, this whole kind of blending of analogies. There's a lot more going on here in regard to this, as we've talked about previous comments from Klaus Schwab about literally, not figuratively, literally blending your biology with technology. That's called technocracy. That's exactly what we've been talking about. But again, that's also fake news, according to, you know, the elitists, 1% in the right places of the world. But today we're going to get into that topic as well as something we've touched on before in regard to, or I mean, in addition to, it ties in with the same thing, this whole virus mimicking nanotechnology, the virus sized transistors. You know, interestingly enough, the exact thing that Charles Lieber was working on. There's more there too we're going to talk about, but also how it ties in with what we're now seeing today from the mainstream media about this so-called timing, the origin of, oh, look, now we're seeing that it started back in the middle of 2019, or maybe in December, but no, we see it circulating in the U.S. All these claims that we had said on this channel, not that it were fact, but that we should be considering based on the data, were censored. Because that's, you're not allowed to consider new facts and then, you know, bring it into your perception without asserting that that's the absolute fact, right? That's only mainstream media. But now they're allowed to talk about it because then they're saying it, which is always how this goes. It's only fake news up until the media is allowed to say what they're supposed to say about it. We're going to get into that, showing you that the number that they're now telling you seems to challenge the entire narrative. What about all the people that were removed for saying this back then? Who cares? But then we're also going to talk about the vaccine, and how that ties in with the concept of this mimic size, virus-sized technology, and the illusion that is the COVID-19 vaccine program that I've been telling you from the very... I think Ben Swan just did a great video about this with RFK Jr. I mean, this is... I'm so happy to see this continuing to flesh out. We've been talking about this... I mean, I can't, since the moment these programs, Operation Warp Speed, were talked about, we've been pointing at these actual information. Forbes came out with an article after that, by the way, that we've continued to point to. That also is correct, even though that's now being pointed to as misinformation or being misunderstood. It's very clear. And I'm going to show you a new study from the BMJ that also says exactly that, as well as a few very key things that seem to cut at the root of the entire illusion that this thing is as dangerous as they're making it out to be. All of this stuff is factually based. It's sourced. It's information you can read for yourself. Most of it almost entirely coming from the sources they're telling us we're supposed to be listening to. Nonetheless, it will still be censored and controlled and removed because I'm framing it in a way that they don't like, otherwise called the truth. But we'll get to it all today. Now, let's start off again with the Klaus Schwab, the idea of what we heard in the beginning there. For those that didn't catch that in the beginning, the clip, I will be playing it again as we get further down here. But that was Klaus Schwab discussing the idea of a cyber pandemic. And now here is the actual website where they're talking about this stuff. And I want to reiterate how ridiculous it is that these are things that are supposedly not real, according to the mainstream media, or, you know, the idea of the Great Reset, as it were, you know, as an individual concept. This is the website, CyberPolygon, which is actually linked to in their World Economic Forum information, and it's talking about exactly what he repeatedly states in that interview, CyberPolygon. It says, in 2020, CyberPolygon became a unique event combining two tracks. All right, so that's what this is, the whole thing. This event was kind of co-opted, I guess, by these people. Whether you're talking about the World Economic Forum or, you know, the kind of, I would argue, the technocratic COVID-19 manipulators, put it as simple as possible. So they took the cyber summit and then blended it, apparently, with other things that tie in with COVID-19. Pretty interesting. Almost exactly what we've been telling you that, you know, Whitney's been talking about. I mean, it's all there for you. The world's largest cybersecurity exercise for corporate technical teams, an online conference featuring senior officials from international organizations and leading corporations such as the WEF, World Economic Forum. The central theme of the event was a digital pandemic. How to prevent a crisis and to reinforce cybersecurity on all levels. Hence, CyberPolygon 2020 aimed to develop the team. So, but the point is, digital pandemic, same difference. What does that actually mean? Are they using it as an analogy to say that it's a pandemic in regard to a cyber attack? Or are they actually kind of floating something much, much larger? Well, you would be inclined to say, well, it's probably just an analogy. And of course, that's what the media will want you to think. And I'm not saying I have definitive one way or the other, but I'm going to go over some information today that I want you to consider for yourself and ask yourself whether there is more going on here. Let's just start from the horse's mouth. Klaus Schwab, the Great Reset will lead to a fusion of our physical, digital, and biological identity. Not, you know, hypothetically speaking, or an analogy of, but this is what, and you can watch the full thing. It's very clear what he's saying. And this is not a new idea. This has been, James Corbett's been talking about this for a decade. The idea of a technocratic direction. You know, the idea of transhumanism and blending ourselves with the, you know, putting consciousness on a computer. All these kind of ideas are around this same mindset where these people believe that they can, you know, essentially make people live forever, as well as remove disease. And, you know, in some ways that could be framed to sound like a good thing. Except when you realize that you're removing all concepts of anonymity or as identity or any of these things. I mean, this is why World Economic Forum, in regard to the Great Reset, has floated the idea, actually, since I'm saying it, 2024? No, I think the date is wrong, but let's see. 2025, maybe? Well, you've seen the article where it's World Economic Forum saying, oh, here, it's 2030. Wait, so I guess, so 5 years later. Here's how life could change in my city by the year 2030. Oh, they've actually changed this. Are you serious? Look, you can see it right here. That's ridiculous. Anyway, the point was, it's 2030. And you got, oh, look at that. I love how they forget to change their SEO when they change the titles. It's 2030. I own nothing. I have no privacy and life has never been better. That's actually what that headline is. Except they realized people weren't happy about it. So they clearly changed it. Don't you love how honest and open they, I mean, gosh, I've stumbled into those things on accident on this show all the time because they're changing things. They're rewriting history in real time. Anyway, here's another one saying the same thing, I believe, on The Independent. You'll own nothing by 2030. Of course, leaving off the, and you'll never be happier. Like, nobody is in line with this. You can look at the information around, like, this is a point somebody else made about storage units. The business of storage units was non-existent not too, you know, so many years ago. It is booming. One, because people are being displaced and moved and, you know, losing their homes and so on. You know, that's where we are right now. But on top of all of that, it's because people just don't want to get rid of their stuff. But regardless of how you feel about it or whether you think it's good, the idea is that this is what they want you to drive towards. The idea that you don't have privacy, that you don't own anything, that you're basically living in this collectivist hive mind society. That's where this all comes back to. This is the commentary from the other person. This is the guy peddling the Great Reset, the Great Agenda. But here, listen to it for yourself.
What the fourth industrial revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities.
Not hard to misunderstand. Pretty clear. Here's another one. These technologies will operate within our own biology and change how we interface with the world. Smart dust, arrays of full computers with antennas, each much smaller than a grain of sand, can now organize themselves inside the body. So, we're two tweets in and taking a quick step back. Do we still think digital pandemic is just an analogy? As we're literally talking about blending your identity with technology, about using these kind of things inside of your body. You know, these things are supposed to be fake news if you talk to anybody on Twitter. The blue checks, actually. Well, the point being, guys, is there's a lot going on here. A lot. It's very clear that there's much more happening in this conversation that the media wants you to understand, which is just simply called dishonesty. There's no way around that. You can say it's dishonesty for a good reason. That's sure hopeful of you to think that's what they're doing. But at the end of the day, they're lying to you. They're misrepresenting the information, calling this stuff fake news. And then when you really press into it and be like, well, here's the whole thing on their website, they go, well, we didn't mean it wasn't real. We're saying that the way it's being presented is, you know, and then they equivocate. The bottom line is people watch that and they think, oh, Great Reset's fake. Didn't you hear it's fake? It's not, though. And this is all very clear. They want to redesign our world for the benefit of what they want you to think is society, but ultimately comes down to we think we have a 1% versus 99% now. Wait until you've got a very small collection of billionaires that control how we all facilitate the things that we don't own. Wait for that. But nonetheless, guys, the bottom line is, and I'll play that more in a minute. I might as well just play it now since I'm going to play it again in a minute on top of that. But listen to him say this again, because this is the point that I said in the beginning. Just in case you missed it, you jumped on the show late, here's what I played in the beginning.
It is obvious that governments have to play a leading role in securing cybersecurity, but ultimately, cybersecurity is a challenge for all of us. It is important to use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect.
So a timely opportunity, is that not the conspiracy theory that we're not supposed to be spreading, that they're using this pandemic to achieve an agenda, right? Apparently that's only conspiracy theory when you frame it in the way that they don't like. When Klaus Schwab sits on the stage or Hillary Clinton tweets it out and says, this is a time to use this thing to make this happen. And then we say exactly that, you're a conspiracy theorist. Theorist. But the point is, guys, that it's clear that that's what they're saying. I'm not even trying to add on my own perspective or slant it in a way that makes it sound evil. He's literally saying that COVID-19 has given us an opportunity to achieve what he wants to achieve. Now, he's saying it as a way that's better for everybody, and maybe you agree with that. But there's no way to pretend like what I just said is fake news. It's been talked about. It's been openly discussed. They're just trying to gaslight everybody so they don't know what to believe. He literally just said that's what we need to be doing.
COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to use the COVID-19 for us. It is important to use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect on the lessons the cybersecurity community can draw and improve our preparedness for a potential cyber pandemic.
When you're talking about improving things, it's change. That's change. That's doing things based on the idea that we're in the middle of something that, yeah, it's real bad, but we can use it. It's an opportunity. That's supposed to be conspiracy theory. But of course, only when you frame it in a way that makes it sound like they're doing this that benefits them in any way. No, it's entirely altruistic. Don't consider the fact that, I don't know, people like Bill... As I accidentally play the thing I was going to go show you real quick. I wasn't even actually planning on showing you this today. I always do this where it just pops into my head and I say, hey, that's a good example of what I was saying. This is a great video from Really Graceful. Billionaires become $1 trillion richer in 2020. Right, but they're altruistic, though, and this is only for our benefit. You know, it's just really ridiculous how they, it's gaslighting, guys. They want us to feel crazy for asking these questions. And that's why you get all the blue checks and the people that, you know, sycophants that support those people too, that want, they just want to parrot what they're supposed to say. So they get the little cyber pat on the head and they think, ooh, I was part of the, you know, I did the right thing. It has nothing to do with the truth, because how often have we seen this stuff spin around and they realize the people that were laughing at you going, you're so dumb, you clearly don't know what's going on, look at the CDC, and then it turns out they're wrong? Do we ever circle back and go, look at all you people that were, that doesn't happen. There's another excuse they have for why what they said then was wrong, but here's why you were still more wrong than I was. It's just, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. But taking this information, the idea of the cyber pandemic and the idea of, you know, of exactly this kind of thing in particular, the idea of the nanotech idea of using these things internally as a way to achieve the things they're talking about. Remember that I just talked about this for probably the 15th time, but I referenced it at the end of a show, I don't know, a week ago. Just to keep you in the mindset. And I didn't do that because I knew this show was coming. I know that this is relevant. There's something happening here. And there's one of the obvious questions we need to ask is why Charles Lieber was just kind of shuttled away and no one's heard from or talked to him. It's just like this, the leading individual in regard to making virus-sized transistors. Machines that can mimic viruses. Doesn't that seem wildly relevant to where we are? And the important part about all of this stuff, guys, is they want... What they're saying here is not that this stuff, I mean, that these kind of things exactly are what they're saying is fake, but we know it's not fake. You're looking at it, right? I'm going to show you a few more in a minute of actual studies that show these exact things. So it's not that it's fake news. What's fake news is that is the way that, I mean, at the end of the day, if we can see that it's real and it is real, what they're not saying that this item is fake news. What they're saying is the way that we think they're going to use it is fake news. Right? Because if we can look this stuff up and it's very clear that the US government's been working on these things for decades, well, that would make them look pretty dumb. But that's why they just call it fake. And then when it actually comes down to it, they're going to say, no, it's because they're claiming they're going to put it in a vaccine. But you didn't really make that differentiation, right? People think that these things don't exist. And if all it really is about whether or not they're willing to use it in that way, well, you're also wrong, CNN, Fox News, and every other mainstream outlet, because history is very clear that if and when they have the opportunity to do something like this, they usually do. And that's not my opinion. That is history. The abuse of the testing on unwitting people. I mean, we've talked about any number of these examples on this show 100 times over. So the idea that we think it's crazy that they might do this, or one person might do it when nobody else is aware they're doing it because they're in a powerful position, why do we think that that's crazy? It's crazy to act like that's crazy because the history is there. So going forward on that, realize they're not saying this doesn't exist. They're saying what you're going to do with it is fake news. So I'm going to circle back to this in a moment and read to you what it actually says. 2011. But starting here, I wanted to give a shout out to High Impact TV as well as World Alternative Media, because both of them were covering this story yesterday. And I just want to give a shout out because it's a really interesting story. Now, I want to be very, very, very clear about this topic. I am not claiming that this is happening, that somehow these things could be used on these tests is possible, is the only thing we're talking about. And I want you to understand that. And the only reason it's relevant today is because of this being very real and the ties to Charles Lieber and the idea of how that very clearly ties back to COVID-19. And then that ties back to the idea that the people leading the Great Reset on the heels of COVID-19 are also talking about the exact same kind of thing that Charles Lieber was working on that now seems relevantly connected to COVID-19. But those videos will be in there for you to watch. A shout out to both of them for doing great work. Now, I'm going to try to be very careful with this topic because all I want you to do is think about the concept of the facts that we're discussing. Facts from the studies, facts from the information around this whole big thing from the history to today. And then ask yourself whether or not that's something that a government that has had history of testing on people unwittingly, 239 times in history they've admitted to testing unwittingly on either foreign or domestic civilians. Whether that's chemical or biological, they've done it 239 times. That's admitted by the US government. So we have to ask ourselves whether or not this would be something they might do, especially if they thought it was for in your best interest, assuming that's what they actually care about, but that's what people seem to think. But starting with this one, this is from 2020, October 28th. This is the origin of this, the discussion of these videos. Gastrointestinal resident shape-changing micro devices extend drug release in vivo in your body. So I'm just kind of going forward, say in your body instead of in vivo, so people don't lose that. Okay. But this is October 28th. So in the middle of all of this, in the middle of this pandemic, so we're told, they're working on micro devices that can release drugs, including vaccines. I find that to be quite interesting. Now, I hope you will read through this in its entirety. I'm going to go over the discussions of this because they do a good job. Now, this is on Science Daily. Researchers engineer tiny machines that deliver medicine efficiently. This is on November 3rd. Okay, so you can, this is the source is from Johns Hopkins Medicine. This is what I find interesting is that this is and it probably will be censored, despite the fact that it's coming from whatever you want to call it. The very people that are telling us we should be listening to. It says, inspired by a parasitic worm that digs its sharp teeth into its host intestines, researchers have designed a tiny star-shaped micro device that can latch onto intestinal mucosa and release drugs into the body. Now, clearly this is talking about intestines, but that doesn't mean that's the only place that it is or can be used, right? And that's what's important about this, is that's usually how these things go, is they sort of guide you in a very specific direction. It doesn't always mean that that's exactly how it will be used. But it says that they release, and the mucosa part, remember, intestinal mucosa, but mucosa, remember, release drugs into the body. Now okay, yeah, I actually went here. This is the exact same article with a few additions as all of these. All of them stemming back to this, which you know this show well by now. That's what I'll always make sure you have the origin of this information. Now, this is from November 25th. So again, you can see October all the way to November 3rd was the first discussion. November 25th is when this has really started to be pushed around, discussed, right? It's saying Johns Hopkins researchers, just the point being, this is happening during all of this. This isn't some old research. Johns Hopkins researchers take inspiration from parasitic work for medicine delivery. So in and of itself, realize what they're saying there is that we're using viruses to create a medicine delivery system. All of this weird sudden push into virus discussions, virus everything. Everything's about that right now. It seems very odd. Virus mimicking technology, virus vaccine delivery, that's very strange. Now it says theragrippers are tiny, this is the word you should remember, theragrippers are a tiny shape-changing machine that delivers medicine efficiently to the GI tract, or wherever it ends up. I mean, the point is you could adapt this thing, whether it's in the GI tract or not, to do certain other things. And you'll see what I mean in a minute in regard to the brain. Now it says, inspired by a parasitic worm that digs its sharp teeth into its host intestines, Johns Hopkins researchers have designed this tiny star-shaped micro device, as you can see right here, that can latch onto intestinal mucosa and release the drugs into the body. It says, designed and tested shape-changing micro devices that mimic the way the parasitic hookworm affixes itself to an organism's intestines. Now, that's not the discussion of Charles Lieber working on this stuff and specifically making nanotech that mimics viruses. We've already talked about that. That's mentioned in his own work from Harvard. And we'll go back to specifically that in a minute. This is a current discussion of the same thing, making something that mimics parasitic hookworms. And these are the size of a speck of dust. It says right there, these devices, each roughly the size of a speck of dust, can potentially carry any drug and release it gradually into the body. So again, they'll focus on the fact that it's bowel disease and in your intestines is just where they want you to drive your mind to. It can carry any drug and release it gradually into the body. It says gradual or extended release of a drug is a long sought goal in medicine. Again, I wanted you to realize this is something that's been constantly discussed, sought after. I mean, again, it goes all the way back to 2011, if not way further. That's when they were successfully doing this. So why are we not hearing about this? Why is this the first time that most people are even hearing about the idea of this very small virus-mimicking device that can release drugs into your body in a much more effective way, or, you know, depending on the discussions you're listening to, right? I mean, realize, if we're talking about 2011, this is being done. Why are we only hearing about it? And even on top of that, even if this is just happening in October, why aren't the American people being hurt? This would be a big deal, right? This should be news. Brand new thing coming out. I mean, they'll talk about hypothetical discussions about vaccines maybe working, but they won't even give you this kind of information at all. Why? Because they know that it sounds alarming to people. Of course, it's not about actually informing you. It's about controlling the way you think about things. That's news today from the mainstream media. But it says thousands of theragrippers can be deployed in a GI tract in your body. Gracias, I guess is her last name, notes advances or maybe gracious notes advances in the field of biomedical engineers in recent years. Engineering. We have seen the introduction of dynamic microfabricated smart devices that can be controlled by electrical or chemical signals. So again, there's a few examples of this kind of squeaking out that can be controlled by electrical chemical signals, meaning they can be controlled from outside your body. And that is what another one of these says as well. Let's read it again. We have seen the introduction of dynamic microfabricated smart devices that can be controlled by electrical signals or chemical signals. That's a big deal. So if we're talking about something, the hypothetical idea that people are resistant to a vaccine, that they already tell us most people, 50% people aren't going to get it, what are we going to do? It says the Johns Hopkins researchers fabricated the devices with about 6,000 therogrippers per 3-inch silicon wafer. The technology is available for licensing through Johns Hopkins Technology Ventures. Interesting, huh? How Johns Hopkins was also involved with Event 201 before this all started, you know, or many other examples that we could point out that very clearly show foreknowledge in any number of things we continue to point to. But this is just one example. As we go forward, you will see this is not new, and in fact is something that we should have heard about by now. This is from June 28th, 2016. Hydrogel nanoparticles and nanocomposites for nasal drug vaccine delivery. Remember, the idea of these inside your body nanotechnology, fake news, right? Didn't Bill Gates and his wife just say that it was fake news and that's totally crazy? Guys, these things have been around for a decade or more. I mean, I said that the last time I heard them say that. It's just pathetic that they really believe that they can either trick people. That, I mean, I think what it is, what's pathetic is that that there's that many people who are still blindly listening to what they're told. You'd think we would learn by now. But it says, over the past few years, remember 2016, nasal drug delivery has attracted more and more attentions and been recognized as the most promising alternative route for the systemic medication of drugs limited to intravenous administration. So over the past few years, so it goes further back before 2016, and they're saying drug delivery has attracted more and more attention and has been recognized as the most promising alternative route, nasal drug delivery. If it's the most promising alternative route for this, why has nobody heard about it? That may not be as big as I feel like it is, but that's crazy to me that this is supposedly this big new thing, and but I'm sure some people have heard about it. But the idea that we're talking about nano devices, or even specifically, it's nanocomposites, nanoparticles. They were talking about smart dust and nanoparticles going up your nose into your brain. That's pretty big deal. And the fact that it even works should be big news. And the fact that it continues to work and not only work, but then acknowledged as the new leading example of how we do these things. But still, nothing. I guess Fox News and CNN just had the day off that day. It says, thus, research efforts have considerably been directed towards the development of hydrogel nanosystems. You know, the fake news thing that we talked about and were laughed at on the mainstream media, which have mucoadhesive properties in order to maximize the residence time and hence increase the period of contact with the nasal mucosa and enhance the drug absorption. So the point is, intestines, you know, in your stomach, but it's the same thing. We're talking about the same concept here. So here they are years before this, where they want you to now think that it's new and it only applies to your intestines. It's not. You can apply the same idea. And it only gets more alarming as we go further back in time. It says, this is from June 2015. Nano neurotherapeutic approach intended for direct nose to brain delivery. Crazy. We haven't heard about this before. It says methods. Intranasal administration is a non-invasive method. I don't know about that, but we'll come back to that in a minute. Doesn't seem very non-invasive to me, but you know, they call the Profusa bio implantable that goes under your skin inside your arm. They call that non-invasive too. It's not a joke. It says this is a non-invasive method of drug delivery that may bypass the blood brain barrier. Just making sure that is what it means. I'm just making sure the case those that people always want to question everything, which you should be doing. The point is there's some here. There it is. Just want to make sure you guys can see it. Blood brain barrier, BBB, right there. Okay, now, and that's important. I mean, always, you should never just be trusting me about anything. And that's exactly why I do that. right? Because I want you guys to understand that I'm taking the time to read this and not just assume what other people are writing about. But then again, we always make mistakes. You've seen me do them before, right? It's about the effort and doing your best to be as honest and you know, broadcast that's full of integrity as best as you can, right? But it says intranasal administration is non-invasive method of drug delivery that may bypass the blood-brain barrier, allowing therapeutic substances direct access to the brain. It's interesting that as it went forward, it seems to go further away from what it seems to be actually about. But it says, however, intranasal administration produces quite low drug concentrations in the brain due to limited nasal mucosal permeability and the harsh nasal cavity environment. Preclinical studies using encapsulation of drugs in nanoparticulate systems improved the nose to brain targeting and bioavailability in the brain. However, the toxic effects of nanoparticles on brain function are unknown. We'll just pretend like they figured that out. It says the review discusses the role of nanotherapeutics in treating brain disorders via nose-to-brain delivery. The mechanisms of drug absorption across nasal mucosa to the brain, strategies to overcome the blood-brain barrier, nano-formulation strategies for enhanced brain targeting via nasal route, and neurotoxicity issues of nanoparticles. 2015. 2013, from October. Nanoemulsion-based intranasal drug delivery system of this specific drug, which is an HIV drug for brain targeting. It says the low permeability of anti-HIV drugs across the blood-brain barrier leads to insufficient delivery. Therefore, developing a novel approaches enhancing the CNS delivery of anti-HIV drugs are required for the treatment of neuroAIDS. The aim of this study was to develop intranasal nanoemulsion for enhanced bioavailability and CNS targeting of that specific drug. So from 2013 to 2015 to 2016, all the way to 2020, we're seeing the development of this very same thing. And it's always about, and seemingly before 2020, it was all about the blood-brain barrier. Weird how that just suddenly doesn't get discussed anymore. Seems interesting. But coming back to this before we go forward, this is 2011. The timing of this is very important. Not this as well as 2011, as well as when Charles Lieber was actually, I guess, just removed from the situation. I'd love to find out what's going on with Charles Lieber right now, but it's weird how, does he have family? Is he in Guantanamo? I mean, what's going on, right? It's interesting. But January, February 2011, virus-sized transistors. Now it says Charles Lieber, who, in case those, I'm going to go over this in a minute, he was the Harvard professor who was arrested with two Chinese nationals on January 28th, which was clearly in this hype about COVID-19. It was talking about the same thing with Wuhan and the same kind. I mean, it's odd, the crossover that seems on its surface level, at least according to the mainstream narrative, to not really have any tie to what's actually going on with COVID-19. But that's where I think we're wrong. I think that it very clearly does. Charles Lieber uses nanowires, 2011, to create a transistor so small that it can be used to enter and probe cells without disrupting the intracellular machinery. These nanoscale semiconductor switches could even be used to enable two-way communication with individual cells. So remember, we have the ability to control them from outside the body with electric signals, and now apparently the ability to communicate, which I argue is probably the same thing. But that's quite interesting, don't you think? I feel like that could be, like, if not, that alone could be enough to justify what we're dealing with here. The ability to essentially, I'm trying my best to not jump into speculative stuff here, because all of this, the facts on its face are enough, in my opinion. Charles Lieber, who was the leading individual in the world in this technology, right when this all kicks off, is just disappeared. I just find that very revealing. It says Lieber has worked for the past decade on a design and synthesis of nanoscale parts that will enable him to build tiny electronic devices. It says when he finally engineered the tiny device and tried to insert it into a cell, right, 2011, meaning he did this long before that, most likely. However, it says when he finally engineered the tiny device and tried to insert it into a cell, he had no luck. Pressing hard enough to disrupt the cell membrane, he reports, killed the cell pretty quickly. But when his team coated the hairpin nanowire with a fatty lipid layer, the same substance the cell membranes are made of, the device was easily pulled into the cell via membrane fusion. a process related to the one cells used to engulf viruses and bacteria. Let me say that again. The device was easily pulled into the cell via membrane fusion, a process related to the one cells used to engulf viruses and bacteria. Again, this mimicking idea, this innovation is important, Lieber explains, because it indicates that when a man-made structure, is as small as a virus or bacteria, it can behave the way biological structures do. I just can't stress how important that sentence is. When they make a when they make things this small, virus-sized transistors or nanotechnology that mimics viruses, well, what they're telling you is that it can behave the way biological structures do. So it can act like a virus. So is it not possible that this is something that's going on here today when this weird correlation with the timing of all of this and how this is weirdly tied in with the discussions and the direction of the people that are jumping on the heels of this to use it for this agenda? I mean, there's something strange here. All I'm asking is that you think for yourself about this. Tests of the device indicate that it could be used not only to measure activity within neurons, heart cells, and muscle fibers, for example, but also to measure two distinct signals within a single cell simultaneously. So what I take away from that, for any number of things could go from there, but the idea is that it can measure activity within your body. And you're going to see more going forward, the discussions of medical pre-crime and this obvious direction to do exactly that. That's what that's telling you right there, back in 2011. When scaled down, the difference between digital and living systems blurs. Doesn't that sound familiar? So that you have an opportunity to do things that sound like science fiction. Things that people only have dreamed about. Where have we heard that?
It is obvious. The governments have to play a leading role in securing cybersecurity, but ultimately, cybersecurity is a challenge for all of us. It is important to use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect on the lessons the cybersecurity community can draw and improve our preparedness for a potential cyber pandemic.
And to be quite honest, that's like the most milquetoast version of that statement. But we've seen this from Hillary Clinton tweeting this out, many people saying this, the idea that this is an opportunity, right? And it's in regard to the blending these things, don't forget, that's the other comment that we just talked about. He literally said a fusion of our physical, digital, and biological identities. Says right there. The difference between digital and living systems blurs so that you have an opportunity to do things that sound like science fiction, things that people have only dreamed about. Now, which people? Who knows? Maybe government people. Maybe a perfect society for people. You know, maybe that's what we're dreaming about. I don't really feel that makes sense. I don't know how many average people sit around and dream about virus mimicking nanotechnology and how that can bring things to our lives. I doubt that. He's talking about people, about dreaming about people like that. Dreaming about the future that they're building with this illusion. That's how I see it. Now, looking at this concept. Now, remember that the idea here is that this is something in and of itself that's already been questioned by a lot of very reputable people. That there's actually no reason whatsoever to have the test that goes that far back to your brain. And in fact, there's actually some very important genetic material that can be accessed in that exact kind of way. But the point is here that we have tests already. These tests that have already been sent out around, you know, people, I mean, even people that have gone to take this test have just been handed a Q-tip and they circle it around the inside of their nose and then get it tested for positive for COVID-19. The point is that this idea of going all the way back to the blood-brain barrier, I am openly questioning whether that is actually necessary or even possible to achieve the kind of test that they're achieving or claim that they're achieving. I find that to be very interesting because that it says a lot, especially when you go back to the discussions of the videos that I referenced beforehand, right here, you know, the idea that this is the concept that this test could be delivering something like that is not what I'm saying. That's possible, obviously possible. It's obviously possible that this could be happening, where it's just some plan or some action that we've, as they've done before 239 times, to test this on somebody, or to do it for our best interest because we're being told that, you know, most people aren't going to get it and we're going to do it this way anyway. I mean, these are all hypotheticals. I'm not saying any of those for sure are happening, but what I'm saying is the fact that we're here and the fact that history shows this has happened before, we should be asking these questions. And then, of course, when you get to the point of today where we are seeing that and they are telling us that we need to reach herd immunity or it's going to be bad for everybody, well, could that be something that happens going forward? We've talked about this before. This is the discussion from "Coronavirus Gives a Dangerous Boost to DARPA's Darkest Agendas." This is from May 4th. Whitney Webb, in vivo, in your body, nanoplatforms. Right? I mean, it's crazy that this is supposed to be fake news. Well, here's the one that we referenced that I, in this article, that I, this is even archived. This is not new. It says very clearly, in your body, in vivo, nanoplatforms. It says the program pursues technologies that provide early indication of physiological abnormalities or illness that can be proactively addressed with therapeutics or supportive care. Medical pre-crime. And the idea being that you'll get something like a vaccine, which, by the way, they do consider therapeutics on, such as Pfizer, I believe, in one of their websites. Now, regardless, you get medicine before you're even sick. That sounds like a perfect boon for a system that's already abusing the system, right? The sick care system. They don't want the help. They want, if they can give you drugs without you even being sick. I mean, that's just one aspect of this. Realize that the idea, again, parasite stress theory, the idea of keeping people in the sense of a pandemic scenario keeps them acquiescing to the government. They are more willing to be led by an authoritarian control structure under the guise of some threat of a pandemic. That there's been multiple studies. If a government wanted to create an authoritarian government where they had top-down control, that's how they would do it. A pandemic. Even if it was fake, that's what the studies say. It doesn't have to even be a real pandemic. So if you're asking, why would they do Big Pharma? It's not the only reason. No, there's not. There's 1,000 reasons. And I've listed them all over the show. But the point is, we go over one, and then the next one, the next show we do another one. And these people that don't want to believe it, they'll watch one show and be like, that's fake. There's no way that would happen. But you need to do more than watch one thing and just, you need to flesh out the full picture. It's not just about money. It's not just about control. It's not just about technocracy. It's not just about contact tracing. It's not just about anything. It's about all of these things. And there's powerful people driving these agendas. And yes, there are a few things I would argue that are most focused here. But there's so many things happening. That's why you've got governors like Newsom, who I argue aren't directly tied into the top of this agenda, but they can clearly see the writing on the wall and they're clearly abusing their power. That's just a byproduct of people who are dishonest in positions that are for dishonest people in our system today. Government, politicians. Medical pre-crime is what that says. But then it goes on to say, effort aims to develop a generalized in-your-body platform that provides continuous physiological monitoring for the warfighter, or you, investigates technologies that incorporate implantable nanoplatforms composed of biocompatible non-toxic materials. Fake news, though, right? So when we're talking about this stuff all the way back then and talking about medical pre-crime and all of this stuff, are we to believe that they weren't aware of what Charles Lieber was working on? That they weren't driving what he was working on? That this is the biggest focus and it's the biggest, newest thing about the nasal and blah, blah, blah? We're going to pretend like this wasn't something they were very eagerly trying to drive forward? The fact that he was working with a lot of foreign entities over in China is not new. It's not even rare. Right now, it's happening all over the place. Even in regard to the Wuhan Institute of Technology, or the Wuhan University, whatever, in Wuhan, that was one. That was one of the entities that is currently under contract with the NIH. And they just said, well, remove that one. And then left all the other ones. So if China bad guy is making this whole thing happen, why'd we leave all the other ones happening? They're still funding research that's happening in China. And of course, they're still working with people in the United States. That's what we have to understand about this whole narrative about Wuhan. The North Carolina University, and that's where the material came from. The funding's coming from the NIH and from the U.S. government. Even the idea of the research started in the United States before they pushed it off over into China. So even if China's involved at all, and I very clearly think they are, it's in collusion with the U.S. government. I mean, it's just, that's what it appears to me. But either way, we're talking about something that is very clearly tied in with this whole discussion that they're just afraid of you talking about. Not a secret. Now, so people understand who this is, like I said before. The Department of Justice announced today, this is on January 28th, that the chair of Harvard University's Chemistry and Chemical Biology Department and two Chinese nationals have been charged in connection with aiding the People's Republic of China. Now, one of these guys was caught with biological material in his sock, trying to smuggle it away from Beth Israel Hospital. So there's clearly more to this story, guys. There is something going on. Dr. Charles Lieber, who was 60, was chair of the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Harvard, was arrested and charged by criminal complaint just with one count of making a false statement. So where is he? What's going on? I mean, that's treasonous, I guess. It is. I mean, under the definition of it. But one false statement? I mean, you would think we would have heard something more about this. It seems like there's a hell of a lot more happening with this guy. But regardless, January 28, 2020. Now, actually, before I even get there, remember the date. The point is the date and how this relates to where they're now saying this sort of started. But before I do that, I want you to realize this interesting chemistry tree. Here is Charles Lieber, Harvard. It just show, and there's a lot here. I recommend you dive into this and start checking other people out on this. But I just did some of these this morning. I wanted to point out that if Charles Lieber is pulled out of this equation, I want to question what that means for the rest of the people working on the exact same stuff. Now, this is, and by the way, people that are also still currently tied to the same entities that Charles Lieber was working with. Doesn't make sense. But I just pulled out a couple of them. Here's one, Bozy Tian from Chicago. Okay, he's an associate professor at the University of Chicago. Here's what he's working on. It says, first, we're interested in imitating cellular behavior with semiconductor nanomaterials and augmenting existing biological systems with semiconductor components. We hope to stably incorporate inorganic materials into pre-existing cellular frameworks. Sounds an awful lot like what Klaus Schwab is talking about. Examining both how single cells interact with these new artificial components and what uniquely inorganic properties we can exploit to derive a more nuanced control over these cellular systems. So blending technology with organic material and then finding ways to exploit it to derive more control over those cellular materials. You know, your body. Okay. It's not secret, guys. This is happening as we speak. And this is openly talking about the very thing that they're saying is fake news. Here's another one. And this one's further down here, I believe. This one was Stanislaus Wong. Just want to show you this. There's a lot of people going on here. Sunny Stony Brook in New York. Functionalized single-walled carbon nanotubes as rationally designed vehicles for tumor-targeted drug delivery. Right? All this stuff is the same idea. Now, I want you to look at science from February 4th. Okay? So we're talking January 28th. This guy's arrested. February 4th, this is what they write about what's going on here. Why did a Chinese university hire Charles Lieber to do battery research? My opinion, this is an aggressive effort to bury what really happened here. I just went over some very basic, very public documents that show you that they were working on a hell of a lot more than battery research. I mean, for crying out loud, it's right here in his documentation about what they're actually working on. But here's what it says. Lieber was arrested on 28th of January on charges of making false statements to U.S. law enforcement officials and federal funding agencies about a collaboration he forged with researchers in China. But it wasn't a secret, guy. I mean, I've already went over this in past shows. This is stuff that was being worked on in plain day. He was released 2 days later on a $1 million. And again, the point being, collaboration he forged with researchers in China. So they're arguing that he just falsely stated a part of what they were working on. Not that it was actually something bad, because here they're currently doing these things right now. That's relevant. But it says he was released 2 days later on a $1 million bond. An affidavit outlining the charges against Lieber notes that in January 2013, he signed an agreement between Harvard and Wuhan University of Technology in China. Right? And I already showed you that there are at least five others that I saw between the NIH and other technology research units in China. Okay, and they're also all working on the similar same kind of thing. We're talking about gain-of-function research. You know, making bioweapons. But it says, an affidavit outlining Charles Lieber notes in January 2013, he signed the agreement in China. According to the affidavit, quote, the stated purpose of the agreement, which had a 5-year effective term, was to, quote, carry out advanced research and development of nanowire-based lithium-ion batteries with high performance for electric vehicles. Right. So that's what they're framing it as. But understand what we just talked about. Nanowire-based lithium-ion batteries. Electric. What we're talking about, guys, is the vehicle, in my opinion, behind these things. Because we already talked about this idea. What they're actually talking about are what these things essentially are. There are many nano devices that are covered with a layer of the lipid material they were talking about that essentially dissolves after it gets into the certain area of the body temperature. And then what happens then is you can see it starts out like this, and then, or actually starts out like this, and then once it dissolves, it pulls itself together and it clamps down on the mucous tissue, which then releases the whatever they put in there, right? So that's the idea, but it doesn't have, so we're told, something like an engine or something like that that can keep it going after it serves its purpose. It just lets go and it goes away. So we're told, right? Who knows if that's even true? But what if what he was working on, as remember, this is back in 2011, and this is what they're discussing now today on November 25th, something that could, in fact, keep it doing something or allow them to, and it's funny that they say nanowire based, and they reference that 100 times over in these things, nanowire composite. This, I mean, it's clearly what they're talking about. But of course, science is making it about batteries for cars. It says officials at the Wuhan Institute of Technology have not responded to requests for comment on their agreement with Lieber, but it outlines just the kind of high-tech work that U.S. prosecutors involved in efforts to investigate Chinese attempts to acquire advanced technology from U.S.-based researchers say they are concerned about. It says they allege that the Chinese government has used such collaborations to improperly take advantage of the federally funded research enterprise and gain an edge economically and military advance. So what do they, I love how they say this. This is the kind of thing that the secret Chinese are trying to, you know, the way they frame it. But then they go on to say that it's collaborations. They're talking about the NIH using public funds to fund collaborations between these groups. And then also the same thing happening from China in regard to researchers here, something that they're well aware of, something that they're currently doing right now. But because they want to make it seem like something really bad and evil, they say China abused this because what, Lieber made a false statement about one thing that they were doing? Now, look, I'm not trying to make it out to be that he's not bad or that I don't know. All we know on here to go off of is claims from the government. My point is that it does not appear to be some bombshell thing they're making it out to be. What it looks like is a way to shuttle away somebody that has a lot to say about something very relevant to what's going on today. But so China worked with this guy, and they just didn't like the way it worked out. In Lieber's case, however, the battery angle poses a puzzle. That's because, what do you know? A search of his titles of Lieber, more than 400 papers and more than 75 U.S. and Chinese patents reveal no mentions of batteries or battery vehicles or vehicles. Gee, I wonder why. You know, it took me about 10 seconds to realize why. And I guarantee it did for them, too. But they just leave that out. It says, in fact, one U.S. nanoscientist and former student of Lieber says, I have never seen Charlie working on batteries or nanowire batteries. Lieber's strategy opened the door to making pristine nanostructures with simple and inexpensive chemical techniques. He went on to show that he could use these nanowires to serve as transistors, complex logic circuits, data storage devices, and even sensors. But please, don't make the connection between what you just seemed baffled about and what you just said. The fact that he's using these things to create transistors. You know, the size of viruses. It seems pretty clear to me. More recently, Lieber's Harvard lab has shifted gears into integrate nanowires with biology. Right, so exactly what Klaus Schwab is talking about. In 2017, for example, he reported creating soft, flexible 3D nanomesh that could be injected into the brains or retina of animals, you know, or humans. Unfurl and wrap around neurons and eavesdrop on the electrical communications between cells. 2011, or this technically it's in this is 2017. Sorry, I forgot we're reading the other one. This is 2020. So 2017. There we go. Flexible 3D nanowire mesh that can be injected into the brain of a person, an animal, something. It unfurls, wraps around your neurons, and eavesdrops on your electrical communications between those cells. Do you realize if I even just stated that exactly as a fact, it would be called fake news right now? I mean, does anybody question that? It's incredible how obvious this stuff is, and we're talking about a long time ago here. Other research groups have adopted Liebherr's nanowire growth methods to fabricate nanomaterials useful in making batteries. But that's never been the focus of his research, which begs the question of why his supposed collaboration with Wuhan was focused on a line of research outside his specialty. You just said it. Of course, but the point is they don't want to make that conclusion. Clearly, there's some very, very alarming stuff going on here. Now, I think it's obvious. It's just me, but I think it's quite obvious that there's a crossover here between Liebherr's work, between what currently is happening, between what the World Economic Forum is discussing, and the obvious interesting tie-in between China and the Wuhan Institute of Technology, specifically, where they claim COVID-19 was coming from, and the people that he was working with who got caught literally trying to bring over genetic material. I mean, I can't even understand why this is not a larger focal point. I mean, I do, because the media is a bunch of propagandists that don't care about anything other than what they're told to do. But there's a lot of independent people out there, and I know they've touched on this, but I can't get past what there's something going on here. Very obviously. Now, all that aside, the idea that they have this technology that can deliver medicine inside of your body in a way that could be used specifically like the technology that we just pointed to, that's literally about your blood-brain barrier and actually going inside your nasal cavity and doing it exactly like that, that just so happens to look exactly like the COVID test that we already know isn't actually appropriate for testing for COVID, if it's even there at all, because, you know, on and on and on. But I'll leave it there. But I want to continue on with this train of thought, going off of the concept of January 28th. January 28, 2020 is when this guy was quieted, wherever he is now. I mean, I've tried to find something. I mean, he's not a public character necessarily, so it's hard to figure out, but I would love people out there. I'm not talking to abuse his privacy. I'm not talking to do anything illegal, but I would love to find out where this person is and if he's safe or if he has something to say. I'd love to talk to him. But I'm going to go ahead and guess that's probably going to be really hard to do. But going forward on this topic of January 28th. Think about the timing of all of this. He's arrested January 28th. Right before that, we know that we had all those things, one of the worst supposed flu seasons in this country. We had the ground glass opacity outbreak of vaping illness, as they pretended it was. And then there's the other side of that where they had the cold outbreak that also had the ground glass opacity in the lungs. All these things that they say were markers of COVID-19 back before they stopped talking about that, but were all happening in the mid-2019, right around these areas, right, you know, a stone's throw from Fort Detrick, you know, the usual. And then we have the World Military Games that comes directly from this area over and I mean, on and on, all these interesting tie-ins where that could have been a crossover right there from what we're talking about. The fact that the World Military Games, the U.S. military, who always does, competes at the top level, scored very, very low. Didn't do any social media. What was going on? It's odd. Of course, we have actual witnesses or people that have on the record said that they were U.S. military who were sick, that there's other people that were sick while they were there, that they were all mingling near and in the market area. I mean, there's a lot of this that goes forward, as well as the fact that Fort Detrick has, as they've stated themselves, they had, and up until 2017, I believe, they had one leak every 3 days for 7 years. That's their stated information. And we're talking about BSL-4 lab, coronavirus, Ebola. These are all things that they had one leak every 3 days for 7 years. And we're not pretending that that's not an issue there, to look at that one place that had outbreaks around that right before it started. And then it was shut down quietly because they had a leak. And then they said national security, we can't talk about it. All this is easily documented. I've shown you all of this. Anyway, as I can't not talk about that when we jump into it, January 28th, Liebherr's arrested. So now we're beginning to find out, at least as the narrative goes, that they're saying, well, this started way back in the, at least in December, but some are saying in the middle of 2019. First of all, it's really stupid that we talked about that in the beginning of all this, not as a fact, but here's some information. Here's what this looks like. It says, here's other countries saying that they have evidence long before December. Censored, deleted. Everything you could imagine. But now the mainstream media is finally coming around to argue this narrative, which I'm not even sure is the fact anymore. But this one's from September 18th. So September, they say quietly, study hints COVID-19 may have been in early, you know, as early, the U.S. as early as December, and then just ignore it. Don't ever follow up on it. but except for today or yesterday. Now they follow up and say, guess what? The exact same thing. So it's weird how you can't connect the things and be like, another study. No, they just do the same thing. Coronavirus could have been spreading as early as mid-December. Study suggests. It's like, okay, they don't even reference the other study. Doesn't that seem relevant? Of course not, because they don't have any intention of fleshing that out. This is just being floated now for whatever reason they're being told to float. Because when we said this months ago, it was fake news. They laughed. They said, censor because you're challenging guidelines and blah, 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 which is what I said. How embarrassing. Remember when T-Lab and many others were censored for reporting that the evidence strongly pointed to it starting earlier than the mainstream media is parroting? It's about controlling the narrative for them, guys, not reporting the truth. And I know you know that. But here is a much more reputable outlet, Miami Herald, saying the same thing. And guess what? It's from the CDC. COVID-19 was silently spreading across the U.S. as early as December 2019. This is not that much of a stretch because we've already had this kind of nebulous time frame between December and January, even though they continue to scream that it all came from China and China did it, whatever that means, while simultaneously saying that it doesn't exist, which doesn't seem to add up, but that you're getting the same argument from the same people on the same side. But this study is telling us December 2019, which directly challenges the narrative. But let's see what they say here. It says data from the new government study paints a different picture. The coronavirus may have been silently spreading in America as early as December 2019. Now, remember, if Charles Lieber was arrested on January 28th and all these things were being worked on up until then, the timing seems very interesting. December, January. The study published Monday in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases adds to growing evidence that the coronavirus had been spreading right under our noses long before testing could confirm it, or long before they wanted to because they knew what it would show, which is my opinion, and that's what I was saying in the beginning, and also making it clear that it was my opinion. However, it says the researchers say widespread community transmission was not likely until late February. What? Like, right off the bat, you're thinking, okay, so it was there, they think. Right? It was spreading. And it's the same thing they're telling us as we're dealing with now. But then they say, but it just wasn't really hurting anybody until late February. So this thing spreads. Supposed to be the biggest pandemic in our history. Once in a century, they say. And nobody's being hurt until late February. And then all of a sudden starts kicking into gear. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. It says some of these early infections may have gone unnoticed because patients with mild or asymptomatic cases may not have sought medical care at the time. Okay, so doesn't that mean that it's just the flu then? If they're not even, if think about it like this. Let me read the last sentence. Sick patients with symptoms who did visit a doctor may not have had a respiratory sample collected, so appropriate testing may not have been conducted. So they just said, you have the flu, and they go, okay, walk away. Doesn't sound like a pandemic. Right? I mean, think about what they're saying right there. That they may not have saw. So if the, basically to sum it up, if the media and the government wasn't screaming at them that they had a pandemic going on, it didn't appear that they did. They didn't know. Apparently no people weren't dropping dead without any treatment or contact tracing or social distancing. They were all just going for a month and a half. Nothing, but they claiming they have examples of it being there. So without the media and the government saying, you're in danger, look is what you have. Those symptoms mean you're going to die. Without that, they come in. Even if they feel real bad, they walk away going, yeah, well, I must have the flu. And nobody's been dying. And they even say it right there. Infections may have gone unnoticed because patients with mild or asymptomatic cases may not have sought medical care. Do you not realize the idea that I said in the beginning that if this thing was left to its own devices under their narrative, we would be people would be keeling over in the streets. Everybody would be dying. Clearly, that's not true. Look at Sweden. Clearly, that's not true. They're not doing what they're saying, what everyone else is screaming they have to do, and they're getting better. Then it says sick patients with symptoms. Right. So no longer asymptomatic. So people who are sick that show symptoms. And according to them, that means that they're the severe cases. Who did visit a doctor. So they go in, they get tested, or they talk to a doctor, and just because there's no sample taken, nobody realizes there's something going on? Guys, I mean, that's just painfully stupid, and it does not even line up with their own narrative. But here's the actual document of the actual study. Serologic testing of U.S. blood donations to identify SARS-CoV-2 reactive antibodies. So they're finding antibodies in people in from December or before. Now it says to determine if SARS-CoV-2 reactive antibodies were present in sera prior to the first identified case in the U.S. on January 19th. Residual archive samples from... Now, I should also say, by the way, just because this is shown, if it did start, if it's even real, long before, that doesn't mean absolutely that it didn't come from China. It doesn't mean absolutely anything. It just simply means that the time frame has changed. But I think the point is we don't know at all, even close, even remotely to where it started, if that's even what we're dealing with. Because all we know is that that's where it was first pointed at. And ever since then, for political reasons, people have screamed about how it came from China. There's nothing that shows that. In fact, there's mountains of evidence that suggest that at the very least, it was a lot of other places before it was ever noticed in China, which then does seem to suggest that it didn't start there, if it is even really what we're talking about, because it has not been isolated by the FDA and the CDC have both said so. And I'll actually have a point in that in a minute where it clearly shows you that this is something that could be a large illusion based on the testing and based on numerous other things. I've done a couple shows on this. We'll get to that in a minute. Now it says residual archive samples, 7,389 routine blood donations collected. It says from donors resident in the states, California, Connecticut, Iowa, Massachusetts, Michigan, Oregon, Rhode Island, Washington, and Wisconsin were tested at the CDC for anti-SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. It says they're suggesting the presence of, the point is, of those samples, 7,389, 106 were considered reactive, and then 90 of those were available for further testing. Now, 84 of the 90 had neutralizing activity, suggesting the presence of anti-SARS-CoV-2 reactive antibodies. Now, it says, conclusion, these findings suggest that SARS-CoV-2 may have been introduced into the United States prior to January 19th. Now, always remember that these studies are always diplomatic. If they could have 100% and they would say, these studies suggest, or whatever. Or I was just reading, I think I'm going to read it in a minute. There's a study that's very clearly chopping at the root of what this narrative is, but it starts off by saying, COVID-19 is a once-in-a-century pandemic. And it's like, that there's no need for that statement. That has nothing to do with what they're actually researching. But the point is there because they want people who fund their research to read that and go, okay, they gave them that, right? And that they know this. That's why science is so completely politicized today. But going forward, I want you to consider the fact that if they're telling us right now that 2019, December, which already challenges the narrative, remember that we also right now have the World Economic Forum telling us that it was around in mid-2019. How is that? I mean, think about how crazy that is that they're dripping this out to go maybe December and we already have the World Economic Forum. Here's the actual document. Coronavirus came to Italy almost 6 months before the first official case. How does that make any sense to anybody? Now, you could argue that it's because they were using the PCR test, and that could be false because there's a very, very high prevalence of false positives, right? So that's possible that that's what any of this is, that we're getting these cases as far back as you want to look, which is a little different than the antibody discussion. But in this case, where we're talking about these tests, well, that could definitely be a false, an illusion of what we're dealing with. But regardless, we're talking about this from the narrative, right? From the case that China did this and it started in Wuhan and it was bat soup and all those nonsensical things that we know are ridiculous. But it says 6 months. I believe, oh yeah, that's right. I think I had this one. Yeah, I'll come back to that. Now, if World Economic Forum is saying it was around 6 months ago, or around 6 months before the first case, so mid-2019. How is that not being discussed? Where's the mainstream media? Where are the rest of the... I mean, nobody is compiling all these things other than someone like me, showing you all the different states and countries that have said, look, we had this around back in 2013, back in however long ago. And that's very clear, and I've talked about all of them. I don't have any other explanation other than that's something that challenges the narrative, which then shows you that it's not about the truth. Here's another discussion that I've already talked about, COVID-19 origin. This is from First Post. University of Calgary research shows the SARS-CoV-2 may have been evolving slowly since 2013. It says scientists at the University of Calgary in Canada say that the novel coronavirus may have been circulating amongst humans since at least 2013, though not the same variant that is responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic, which doesn't mean it's not SARS-CoV-2. It's saying that it was something that has been around since then and has just simply evolved. The same thing they keep telling us. It may have evolved, and it doesn't mean they suddenly start calling it something else, right? So what they're saying is this is SARS-CoV-2. And if it was around 2013 that was evolving, That means that this is not something that just popped up out of nowhere in China. That means this is something that's been there. Maybe intentionally, maybe not. Regardless, why is nobody wanting to talk about this stuff? All these will be included for you to look at. Here's Bloomberg. COVID-like virus was sent to Wuhan in 2013. Now, this is a similar discussion they're having here. Sunday Times says this. Now, it says, virus samples sent, and this was July 5th, 2020. This one was June 27th. I mean, these are months they've been around. Nobody wants to talk about it. And only now are they starting to go, maybe December. It's pathetic how clearly they're not allowed to talk about things, even with the evidence, right? I mean, if they're willing to report on some secondhand information about one guy in a t-shirt shop in UK about something happening in Syria, or arguably just discuss something that the White Helmet said without any due diligence, or the fact that, oh, Israel told us Iran did this and report that blindly, right? It's obvious they're not really, they don't really care about their journalistic integrity. In this case, though, you have the evidence, and it clearly shows you have governments stating their own intelligence service have found it's very clear, and they just do not talk about it. That says far more than saying nothing. Or it says far more than, I mean, yeah, you get the point. But this one is an interesting point. These virus samples sent to the Wuhan Institute of Virology 7 years ago closely resemble COVID-19. According to a report in the Sunday Times that highlights unanswered questions about the origins of the global pandemic. Scientists, again, it actually just bothers me when we see even by the U.S. government's own assessment, it's not a pandemic. Like, it's just so frustrating that we're dealing with something we're dealing with children. Like, people that are just, you know, stomping their feet and going, no, we're right, and we're not going to let go of this power. Like, it's so, and in the face of all the facts. How many times do we have to show you that the U.S. government makes its own color threat sheet for pandemics before this starts, and we're barely on a level two right now? But sure, let's call it pandemic because that's what they want us to think. So, and this, again, it's just funny how we can look at the facts and the government. Why are we pretending that the government was wrong about what the government is saying today? Anyway, I don't know why I try to batter against people's cognitive dissonance. Scientists in 2013 sent frozen samples to the Wuhan lab from a bat-infested copper mine in southeast West China after six men who had been cleared out, bat feces were contracted a severe pneumonia. Now, remember, that's what we're being told about the story. Who knows whether that's accurate? All we do know is that samples were sent to Wuhan in 2013 of what they're saying is likely COVID-19, or SARS-CoV-2 more specifically. It says the same mine in Yunnan province was subsequently studied by Shi Zhengli, an expert in SARS-like coronaviruses of bat origins at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the very person who was working with the National Institute of Technology, or the National Institute of Health, and multiple other examples of this crossover, right? So this is the person that was working with the U.S. government. It says she, nicknamed Batwoman, as we've all heard, for her expeditions into bat caves, described COVID-19 in a February 2020 paper, saying it was 96.2% similar to a coronavirus sample named RATG13, obtained in the Yunnan cave in 2013. The Sunday Times said that RATG13 is almost certainly the virus that was found in the abandoned mine. It says the differences between the samples may still represent decades worth of evolutionary distance, according to dissenting scientists cited by the article. Now, the bottom line, guys, as I always tell you, this is just one more example. None of these things should be alone by themselves enough to make you think you know everything about the story. This, let alone the fact that they're coming from mainstream media. But the point is, there's a lot of examples out there being floated about the idea that this comes from a long time ago. At the very least, the middle of 2019, right? What they're talking about is March. The new study, which re-examined samples from a lung cancer screening trial between September and March, suggests otherwise. It says the new coronavirus was circulating in Italy since September 2019, a study by the National Cancer Institute. I mean, why in the world would this not be discussed? I think you know why. Here's another one. Was coronavirus really in Europe in March 2019? It says the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 may have been in Europe for longer than previously thought. Recent studies have suggested that it was circulating in Italy as early as December 2019. More surprisingly, researchers at the University of Barcelona found traces of the virus when testing untreated wastewater samples dated March 12th, 2019. Now again, they use the PCR test here, guys, right? I think it says it down here anyway. So the point is that it could, the PCR test in and of itself, right here, could be the reason that this is being tested that way. That's obviously a caveat. We have to consider that. You know, we don't want to be like the people we make fun of where we're saying on this side, look, look, this is fake, but then we're not considering the that argument in another argument we make. All of this has to come together. That's why I'm really beginning to lean into this possible, like, absolute illusion scenario. But I'm, you know, I'm open to new information, as anybody honest should be. March 12, 2019, which again seems to be pretty spot on in regard to this discussion, right? I mean, there's a lot of these that tie together, the timing of it all. But it says the study was recently published on a preprint server. The paper is currently being subject to critical review by outside experts in preparation for publication in a scientific journal. That nothing ever happened, right? Like, so it's funny how it's like, we're going to be peer reviewing this and it's going to be coming out, and nothing. It's not like they peer reviewed it and came out and said, no, it's not true. They just never did anything about it. It says right here, SARS-CoV-2 was detected in Barcelona sewage long before the declaration of the first COVID-19 case, indicating the infection was present in the population before the first imported case was reported. They're talking about Barcelona specifically. Sentinel surveillance of SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater would enable adoption of immediate measures in the event of future COVID-19 waves, which is something we've talked about, Whitney's talked about in the, you know, medical pre-crime aspect, that they're already installing these things in our wastewater systems under us right now. It's already happening. But I mean, is it unclear to anybody what we're staring at here? That there's an endless example of evidence and documentation. I mean, we've talked about Japan, France, Spain, Taiwan, Canada. I mean, I always there's so many of them. All these countries have talked and stated publicly that they have evidence that SARS-CoV-2 was in existence before it was seen in China. Nobody wants to talk about that. The leading Taiwanese virologist said this in the first few months. He said it's very clear. It's like looking at the branches from a tree. You can see that this traces back to the United States. That's an ally of the United States, but who cares, right? Who cares about the facts? We only want the narrative. Grab that microphone, Trump, and say, China did it, like they do every single time. They rush out to grab the microphone so they can set the narrative. That's what happens every single time. Now, going from all of this and the discussion of these really alarming topics, realize that we're already in the position where the vaccine is already beginning to come out based on something that has not been isolated, something that is being used, that they're testing for using a test that is guaranteeing that they will appear like a bigger problem if they're at all. And all of the other things that we could talk about, it seems incredible that they're already beginning to push this out with the idea of the emergency use authorization. As if it's for your best interest and your safety to not test for safety. It blows my mind. It really does. Moderna to apply today for FDA authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine. We also have the UK approving Pfizer's COVID vaccine, putting pressure on the FDA. It's all happening right now. I find it very almost impossible, mathematically speaking, that all of these vaccines that have never been successfully done before by any of these groups all suddenly happen simultaneously and all go over 90%, right? I mean, these people are not sharing tech. They're competing. Each one of these pharma companies are competing to be the vaccine that gets used, or at least used the most, right? So let's not pretend that they're sharing information with each other and saying, here's how it works. Okay, so they've tried and tried and tried and tried. I've already shown you this. A year after they tried, they've been working on mRNA vaccines. They keep unsuccessfully trying over and over. Now, all of them do it simultaneously. All just in time for the dark winter and all get over 90%. Does anybody buy that? And understand that despite all of the media parroting that they're all working and they're all efficacious, none of these media journalists have ever seen the documentation. None of them have actually seen Pfizer's efficacy numbers because it's self-reported. But sure, let's use that number to allow emergency use authorization because it's about your safety and not the vaccine, right? I love that James did this. Thank you for doing this. Just 5 minutes of research into Pfizer, he says, and I've already found enough reasons not to trust them. Why would you? Understand that 5 minutes. Someone should go out there and do an entire show about everything that Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca or any of these groups have been caught for, and it would blow your mind. Here's 5 minutes worth of research. Pfizer fined $2.3 billion for illegal marketing and off-label drug case. Pfizer fined record $84 million for overcharging NHS. 2,600%. Pfizer drug breach ends in biggest U.S. crime fine. Good times. Pfizer pays out to, you've seen this one on the show, to Nigerian families of meningitis drug trial vaccination or victims. Oh, it doesn't end there. He says, oh, he kept going. Here we go. Pfizer ordered to pay $103 million over hormone drug and breast cancer. Pfizer admits bribery in 8 countries. Cool. Pfizer units to pay over $165 million in damages over menopause medicine. Jury, Pfizer must pay $6.3 million damages. And I mean, guys, it goes on and on and on. And this is the company that we're trusting? That the media is just parroting what they say? That Trump says we should be listening to Pfizer and Johnson because they know what's... Where in the world are we? I mean, it's... People have lost their minds. If before Donald Trump, this would have been... I mean, well, I should take that back. This whole big pharma reliance, you know, this whole illusion of the white lab coat knowing everything is something we've been afflicted with for a long time. But right now we're in a position where something is being rushed out is potentially very dangerous. And the companies that we're listening to are companies that have a long history of lying and cheating and stealing and abusing their trust, abusing your trust. But sure, I'm a conspiracy theorist and you shouldn't watch this at all, right? Here is another discussion. WHO plans COVID vaccine insurance scheme for 92 low-income countries. So what this boils down to, because it says that dozens of middle-income countries like you guys, or arguably, I guess, Latin America, a lot of countries. I believe I saw U.S. included, but the point is that, well, no, it definitely won't include Americans because only low-income countries, and it's saying even these middle-income countries are not being included. They're giving them insurance. Why? Because this vaccine is going to cause problems. That is that's why this is happening. But here's the thing. They're arguing that the reason this has to happen is because they need, because of the liability issues. As if we need to make sure that they're going to be taken care of because, listen to what it says. And understand that this is about making sure that these other countries get this thing, even if they arguably don't want it. It says, a vaccine scheme co-led by the WHO is setting up a compensation fund for people in poor nations who might suffer any side effects from COVID-19 vaccines. So, I mean, we already have our vaccine injury, compensation fund. $4 billion plus has already been paid out. So now they're starting this up around the world. Why? Because it's going to hurt people. Now, people will take issue with that statement, but that is an inherent idea with what they're discussing here. Nations who might suffer any side effects. Doesn't that mean that it's harm? Yeah, it does. The mechanism is meant to avoid a repetition of delays. Ah, so it's not about safety. It's about getting the thing out as fast as possible. So they had delays a decade ago during the H1N1 swine flu pandemic, which they also lied about, which also caused a lot of issues, such as narcolepsy, but we don't like to talk about that, when inoculations were slowed down in dozens of low-income countries because there was no liability. Oh, I see. So now we need to give those people liability and then make sure that we just pay off people who get sick. That's what that says, right? There was no liability given. There shouldn't be liability for a medicine company. That's incredible. But because they hype these things up, just like H1N1, I mean, think about that. They hyped it up to make it seem like something that was so dangerous that they had to remove liability. Because why would they want to rush it out? Of course, because it wasn't actually happening like they said it did. Why can't we put that together today? So now they're doing it again. Oh no, we're in danger. It's all happening so fast. We need to remove liability because it's for your safety, even though we're not testing for safety. Hurry. And the point is they're going to remove that liability from these companies so then people around the world won't have an ability to sue them. So they're going to just go ahead and pay them off ahead of time. Here's an insurance plan. So when you get sick and you're, of course, let's pretend like it's going to be some easy one-click button scenario. You're probably going to have to go through months and months of back and forth to actually prove this and prove that. That's insurance companies. That's what they do. But it gets even worse, as we've already seen this coming. they're telling us now? Well, because we know people won't want to get it because you're just dumb and a conspiracy theorist is what they want you to think, not because there's legitimate reasons to be concerned about this thing that's being rushed out and not tested for safety, right? Yeah, because that doesn't make sense at all. Pay Americans $1,000 to get COVID-19 vaccine. Pay you. Now, here's what I want to really sink in here. The lie that they're selling you, the lie that this is going to create herd immunity, despite the fact that they're openly also, well, openly in regard to the site and the company, the media won't tell you this. So open or not, it doesn't get out to the masses, but they're openly saying that this is not even being tailored to stop this thing or to create immunity. It's not. They're openly saying that. Ben Swan, I said, just did a great interview with this with RFK Jr. And we've already been talking about this constantly, battering this into people. It will not stop you from spreading this. It will not stop you from catching it. As of right now, if it ever will. I mean, look at the flu vaccine. It's what, 10, 15, 30% effective? And then even then, half the time, it's, I mean, there were years where they ended up proving that they used the previous one that wasn't even tailored to the current situation. I mean, it's just about giving you this stuff. And on top of that, the vaccine itself has been shown very clearly to increase the risk of other bacteria and viruses, coronavirus and otherwise. That's a fact. The Pentagon study showed it. James Corbett annihilated the response to this, showing you that previous studies very clearly showed that it increased the risk of other bacteria and viral issues. So it's making you more sick, or potentially. So remember, as we go into this discussion, that what they're trying to drive into your mind is that this is going to save you. This will bring you back to normal because we'll get herd immunity. And if we don't, it's your fault. Except that either Forbes is not good at their job enough to know that's not true, or they just don't care and they're lying to you. Let's read this first, and I'll prove it to you. Herd immunity will be a function of two measures, they say. The efficacy of potential vaccines and the percentage of the population who gets inoculated. Oh, I guess they just left out the part where people naturally gain immunity from getting sick and then recovering. Except they already openly stated stupidly that that doesn't exist. Apparently, you've only ever gotten immunity from a vaccine, despite the fact that vaccines were only invented a certain period ago, and then before that, people had gained immunity, and that's where the idea of vaccine came from. But who cares about the truth in history? Just listen to your overlords, right? The only two things you can do is give, I mean, that's what they're telling you. There is no natural idea. It's all about the things we create to give you. But that's simply not true. It says early data from Pfizer and Moderna, which, by the way, has never been verified. It's statements that they've given and they're self-reporting. But here's Forbes as well, happily parroting the numbers. Oh, you know what? I take that back. As always, credit where it is due, despite the fact that I think this article is a big, flat, stinking dumpster fire of lies. But it says right here, which still needs to be scrutinized by experts. So good, glad they said that. Have indicated efficacy levels as high as 95% and 94.5%, respectively. But nonetheless, even though they give you that caveat sentence, it's still being parroted. Headlines, 95% says this and that. They just, people think that's what it means. And of course, when you think efficacy, you think stopping the virus and stopping it from spreading. That's not happening. AstraZeneca's vaccine trial indicated efficacy of up to 90%, although manufacturing issues have eroded confidence and led some, oh, you mean like somebody dying, or I mean, there's any number of things that have happened. Because the vaccines are not 100% effective, which is never, ever, ever the case, and because some people will be unable to get the vaccine for health reasons, like I like how they just float that as if that's the end goal we've always reached before. Never, never, ever in history have you gotten something 100% effective. It just does not happen. It's mathematic. I mean, guys, it's very clear. There will always be the person who simply, whether it works perfectly or not, it won't work with them because of their own body physiology. That's why it's never 100%. And they just, lately it's become a thing. 100%. The test is 100% effective. The new COVID test, we've been seeing this floated. And it should make any honest person laugh out loud. But it says, because they are not 100% effective, and because some people will be unable to get the vaccine for health reasons, which is exactly my point, it will be crucial to get enough people vaccinated quickly enough to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus. Right, the spread of something that arguably is not actually spreading like they're saying it is, and verifiably based on the numbers, not even close to as dangerous as they're saying it is. Most people, about 0.09, very clearly, not really risk, even in that sense, under flu, unless you're over 60. Even in that sense, I'd argue that that's bastardized because of people that have been put in positions where it puts them more at risk, put in nursing homes and so on and so on. But it says that to get enough people vaccinated quickly enough. Enough people vaccinated quickly enough. And that's what this whole thing is all about. I like how they say vaccine for health reasons, because isn't that something that they also have? There have been people who have openly argued that that's irrelevant, that we will not, doesn't matter. No exceptions, right? I think it was the Daily Mail said that. Or they're just arguing it's patriotic. Who cares if you've got health issues? You have to take it anyway for all of our safety. Mindless. But it says a recent peer-reviewed paper published in The Lancet estimated that herd immunity would require between 75 and 90% of the population, 90% to get vaccinated. That never happens. The critical question is, therefore, how doable will it be to achieve a vaccine rate of even 75%? Not encouraging. And here's where they get into the propaganda, where they just tell you how it's all your fault, that we need to do this, and if we're not, we're being conspiracy theorists and we're putting people at risk. A recent Gallup poll found that only 58% of Americans would currently agree to get the COVID vaccine. Again, do we not live in a democracy? Like, if it's 50% of the people that don't want this thing, and it was 50 before, I mean, it shows you that they don't care if most people want something. They know what's best for you. Sit down. You don't know what you're talking about. We've never lived in that side, that kind of idea. Powerful people use their positions to achieve what they want to achieve. Some of them believe that they can do things that help people. Some of them actually want to help people. But arguably right now, the vast majority of people in these positions are sociopathic, like they're all about power and control. There's so many examples of the look at cannabis. Always the best example. Is anybody confused about how 30 plus states have legalized cannabis? It's still illegal, according to the federal government. Clearly they care about the majority opinion, don't they, guys? It says to get over the herd immunity threshold, right? The thing, like I'm going to show you in a minute, is literally not possible with this vaccine. The U.S. should pay Americans $1,000 to get that vaccine that won't actually give you that. Isn't that funny? Argues Robert Layton, a non-resident senior fellow in the economic studies program at the Brookings Institute. The Brookings Institute. You know, Mr. sometimes Iranian subs go down. Sometimes they might not come back up. Who knows why? Mr. False flag guy, right? They're the people that theorize how to manipulate and start wars, at least in that sense. But what they're arguing is that we should pay people to get this thing. Now, that means that Robert either is blindly trusting what he's told about this, like a lot of the media, but they're just talking heads that aren't very smart, that just get told things and then parrot them. Or he knows that that's not true and just doesn't care. Or knows something we don't. That's possible too. But it does not create that. So they're paying you to get something. That should be, the question should be why. Litton's proposal was championed as textbook economics by Gregory Machen. Guess who? A Harvard economist and former chair of George W. Bush's Council on Economic Advisors. The best person we should be listening to. And it says, without intervention, externalities can result in outcomes that are not socially optimal. Uh-oh. So that means, like, you know, if we don't do what we're told and we don't reach herd immunity, well, that's our fault. And because that's not optimal to society, well, we can't allow that, right? Except for the fact that I always think of this and just show it really quickly because it's easy to pull up, that the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights in 2005 that the U.S. government signed, part of UNESCO, which may, it's UN, it's, this is legal, man, this is international law. They state twice, in fact, that the consent should, where appropriate, be expressed and may be withdrawn by the person concerned at any time for any reason without any disadvantage or prejudice. This is about consent in regard to biomaterial, vaccines, anything, medicine. Bioethics and human rights. The point being, if they want to have a therapy, look, a diagnostic, it says any preventative, diagnostic, or therapeutic medical intervention, anything, means you have the right to say no. Period. Now, it also says very clearly right here, under human dignity, the interests and welfare of the individual should have priority over the sole interest of science or society. That's not a comment. That's not a statement. That's not a hypothetical. That's not a question. That's a statement of fact. And that's something the U.S. government already signed, which means if they don't do that, they're violating international law. But we know that they don't care about that. These are just things that they say to get what they want in the moment. That's been clear. The U.S. government has made that clear over and over and over with U.N. mandates and U.N. resolutions that they ignore while pointing to other ones that they want to be seen. It's frustrating. But I want you to see that they state and agree to that your interests are more important than the collective in regard to your personal rights. They cannot force things on you, but they will. But they agreed here, and as it says a second time in the same paragraph, in the same section, It says, consent may be withdrawn by the person concerned at any time for any reason without disadvantage or prejudice. And they can't be like, well, it's best for society. Because that does not apply, guys. Simply does not. Where was I? Don't want to jump ahead. Oh, yeah. That's weird. Way back there. Sorry about that. Now, the idea of what he's saying there is that, right? That your choices can cause problems for the rest of people. And that's what they're arguing just simply can't be allowed. But that violates international law. I just want you to always remember that. It says intervention to correct those kind of things, an externality, can come in the form of a tax, for example, which would be considered a disadvantage, right? Without any reason and without disadvantage or prejudice. They don't care about the law, guys. I think that needs to be very clear. So that intervention, so they can extort you, or I guess that's not the right word. I guess it would be, I know I'm blanking on the word, but they could use that to lean on you, right? That's like the mafia. We're going to make you pay unless you do what we want. For example, like a carbon tax. It says like a carbon tax, or taxing carbon emissions to internalize the negative externality of pollution. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, because a carbon tax does nothing but charge people for continuing to pollute. And all that does is affect the small guy. Do you think that Chevron and all these bigger, I mean, just, that's the first one popped in my head, but any of them, any, you know, even the company like Boeing or these other companies, do you think that they're going to care about paying a little extra money so they can continue doing the business the way they wanted to? It's going to, just like the fines for doing criminal activity, it becomes the cost of doing business. But you know what will matter is you as an individual driving your car to work won't have to pay more because you continue to need to drive your car to work. That doesn't just cease to exist because it costs more. The carbon tax is a dumb illusion. If we really cared about stopping the things that they're making cost more, charge the companies doing it. If you make these companies pay more to actually create the product, that will at least lessen it. Or let's, how about we just change things in general and stop placating the business side of this obvious authoritarian government? I just can't stand that concept. Like, that's a good thing. It's so clearly a manipulation of the information, because guess what doesn't stop? The emissions, the pollution. It continues, you just pay for it. So it's not really about helping anything, it's about making money on the problem. That's U.S. government 101. But what they're saying there is about using this to manipulate you into getting what they want you to do. It says, but intervention can also come in the form of a subsidy for externalities that help society achieve certain outcomes. Vaccinations would unequivocally generate, according to the Forbes magazine, a positive externality helping not only the individual being vaccinated, but also society at large to move a step closer to herd immunity. So again, just like I keep telling you, they are unabashedly flat out stating, unequivocally, it literally says unequivocally generate a positive externality. So no matter what, this will be positive for everybody, everywhere. Unequivocally generate a positive externality, helping not only the individual, but all of society. That's not even true. There will be people that are harmed by this. There will be people that have negative effects, as, by the way, they're already telling us, which is just dumb. It doesn't matter, though. It'll be best for everybody, because that's the fantasy adult illusion that we're trying to pump out there, that this is the best and you have to be good for society and get the medicine the government tells you to because it's good for everybody. You know how many times that very logic has led to very devastating results? More times than I can count. How many times I played the previous swine flu where they lied about that and hurt people with a vaccine that they said they tested, but then put another one out there. That just bothers me, I have to say. Really, a lot. That they would just try to lie to you and float this idea that it's just inherently good no matter what. And by the way, that's, even if it was, even before this, if vaccinations were just unequivocally good for everybody, then you make one that's never been tested before, that's never been successfully done before, and then you rush it out. Yeah, let's go ahead and pretend that still floats after that. But with a U.S. population nearing 330 million people, achieving herd immunity, they say, would require vaccinating between 250 and 300 million Americans. You know, that is if we had one that would actually achieve herd immunity, if it actually does that at all, but who cares about any of that? If the government were to pay $1,000 to each American, right? Sort of the same amount we got for that one check a long time ago that was supposed to last, I guess, forever. This would equate to nearly $300 billion. Think about that. $300 billion. Do you know how much that could save, what that could do to this country? You know how many small businesses that could save? How about this? in the chat, which I'm not even looking at, by the way, but in the chat, everyone out there, if you're listening to this show, what would you prefer? Would you prefer $10,000 to save your business and your family? Or would you prefer to get a $1,000 check to, I guess, say that you'll take a vaccine? Or maybe get your voucher after you get it to try, you know, to submit it to the government for your $1,000. That $300 billion could literally save the economy. Because the point is, we don't need $6 trillion. We need small amounts of injected money into all the small businesses to actually save them. But understand, that was never going to happen. Because one of the big benefits to the big establishment scenario here is that all of the big business was able to gobble up all the small business because of the fact that they destroyed our economy and blamed it on COVID-19. Regardless, just imagine what that $300 billion could do for this country other than paying you to do something that most people don't want. It says, while this is a large expenditure and one that will likely be deficit financed, big surprise, it needs to be contextualized against other costs. Right. So the idea that we're in a bad pandemic that we're all going to die from, oh, it's a way. Right? See, that's how they always play this. It always leans back on the idea that, but we're all in danger. But we're really not, though. And that's the point. The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, projected in June that the pandemic will shrink the size of the U.S. economy by almost $8 trillion over the next 10 years. Oh, yeah, it's COVID-19 doing that, right? It's this virus that's only hurting about the same amount as people that get the flu, but, you know, it's destroying our economy. No, it's the government who is using that to control everything and shut you down so they can roll out the Great Reset and everything else they're achieving and then say that's the COVID-19 doing that to the economy. I can't remember the last time a virus was able to close down economy. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. Obviously, I'm being facetious. The point is they want you to think we have to do this because we're in so much danger. But again, we're actually not. Litton, who proposed the $1,000 payment, offered a similar argument. If the nation doesn't get to herd immunity once the vaccine becomes widely available and has been independently validated, of course, independently means nothing because the independent validators, you're going to clearly find that they have ties back to the same groups, World Economic Forum. It's going to be the same thing every time. But it says if the nation doesn't get that herd immunity, once it becomes available and it's been validated, that we're out of luck. Well, guess that's it. Over. Game over, right? It says the economy will continue to struggle with a weight on its chest, of course, because of this vaccine that didn't get used and the COVID-19. No, because of the government refusing to give you your life back. The argument is they act like their hands are tied and there's nothing they can do until you take this vaccine. Then they can free themselves and give you back your jobs. It's ridiculous, guys. Look at Sweden. We don't need to look any further. You can look at numerous locations that are currently living their lives. They're going to the movies. They're going to the beach. I haven't done this in a few times. Let's look at this. Well, that's one I already looked at, but let me look one more time. Here we go. Actually, that was a good search. Let's see. 2 months ago, 1 week ago. This one's 1 week ago. Now, this is mainstream. I'm going to show you, like, you know how easy it is to just show a couple of streets that are... I mean, the point is, guys, that if you actually talk to people who are there right now, this is 2 months ago. But I'm trying to find something very recent. Yeah. As usual, I should have found it beforehand. But no, just to go back so you can see the point. I mean, I already showed you this. People are out. Living their lives. Going to the movies. Going to the beach. It doesn't make sense. Right? The idea that all those people behind him are putting their lives at risk by just living their lives. It doesn't make any sense. And this guy with his eyes exposed with a cloth mask that increases the bacterial infections is not really helping himself. But if Sweden can be living their lives and going to restaurants and going to the movies and going to the park and going to the beach and doing whatever they're doing and people aren't just knocking over dead everywhere, and even then, the social distancing and the mask is all recommendations. You can see clearly, guys, I mean, it's not very clear, but most of the people are not wearing these things. Yet, they're not falling out of control in a massive pandemic. I don't understand why that doesn't immediately put an end to this entire discussion. If it is what they're saying it is, Sweden would not be the way it is now. End of story. But it's your fault. The American society won't go back to normal unless you get the vaccine, he's literally telling you, you won't go back to normal. Why? Because that's what they're doing. That has nothing to do with somehow they're unable to until you do. No, this is their choice. They're choosing to hold you hostage until you do what they say. Despite the fact that they're already telling you that the side effects will be significantly noticeable in about 15%. What's 15% of 300 million? A lot. Serious, noticeable side effects. And we already talked about this. Significantly noticeable. I mean, this is bad stuff. Why? Because this is being forced on everybody. And understand, even though they're rushing it out, and even though they're already telling you there's going to be all these bad side effects, and it doesn't even give you immunity. It doesn't even stop you from spreading it, as I'm going to show you in a minute. They're still saying, if you don't do it, we're going to keep you hostage. And we're going to make, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Except when you realize that there's more going on here. They're also telling you on top of that, that it could increase your risk of HIV. But don't think about the fact that it could increase the risk of coronaviruses, right? Oh, I thought that was fake news, but it's not fake news the moment that Forbes covers it in a slightly different way. If it can increase, it's called virus interference. And if it can increase the risk of HIV, it can increase the risk of other infections, such as COVID-19. I mean, it's just incredible to me that this is what they're saying. Looking for the term. But anyway, all these are here for you to read, guys. This isn't even new. This is from October 20th. I've already referenced this once. But if it's possible that this could increase your risk of other things, why in the world would you take it if you're not actually at risk? If you're 20 years old and good health, if you're 30, 40 years old and good health, and you have a 0.09% chance of even getting it, and then an even slimmer chance of actually being sick, and then an even slimmer chance of actually dying, why in the world would you take something like this that is barely tested, that is guaranteed to cause you, or I shouldn't say it like that, guaranteed in 15%, or just it is likely to cause in 15% very significantly noticeable side effects, and then the long-term stuff they don't even know, that they're going to be testing inside your body for 2 years. Why? Well, here's some doctors, Dr. Woodgard and Dr. Yeadon, who are saying we need to stop all of this. They're requesting a stop of all vaccine studies and calling for co-signing of the petition. This says on December 1st, 2020, the ex-Pfizer head of respiratory research, Dr. Michael Yeadon, and the lung specialist and former head of the public health department, Dr. Wolfgang Woodgard, it's a weird last name, filed an application with the EMA, the European Medicine Agency, responsible for EU-wide drug approval. The immediate suspension of all SARS-CoV-2 vaccine studies, in particular the BioNTech Pfizer study. Now, the doctors demanded that the studies, for the protection of the life and health of the volunteers, should not be continued until a study design is available that is suitable to address the significant safety concerns expressed by increasing number of renowned scientists against the vaccine and the study design. An increasing number of renowned scientists. Does that sound like fake news conspiracy theorists? Does that sound like people who don't believe in the scientific method, all of their really dumb sidesteps to people that genuinely have concerns about the actual science? I just feel bad for these people on Twitter that just laugh. Oh, you're so stupid. This stuff it's painfully clear. And there's going to come a day where they're going to realize that they were being led along like everybody else. These renowned scientists are telling you that this design is dangerous. On the one hand, it says the petitioners demand that due to the known lack of accuracy in the PCR test, that's a side statement to what this is talking about. But that's they're saying that as if it's a fact, because it is a fact, guys. And I've been showing you that since the very beginning. Due to the known lack of accuracy in the PCR test, the one they're using to tell us where we are right now. In a serious study, a so-called Sanger sequencing must be used. This is the only way to make reliable statements on the effectiveness of a vaccine against COVID-19. This is what I've been saying from the beginning. This is in regards to actual blood sample. You shouldn't be tested if you don't want to be tested, period. But if you want to be, the PCR test is a guarantee to get a faulty answer. You don't know. Look, they're even telling you that. Well, if you get a negative test, you're not sure you're actually not sick. Why even get the test then? Why not just stay, be safe and do what you're doing anyway? Because it's a flip of the coin. But they're talking about using something that's much more reliable. And this is only the only way to make this reliable statements. And this is on the basis of the many different PCR tests and highly varying quality. Neither the risk of disease nor a possible vaccine benefit can be determined with the necessary certainty, which is why testing the vaccine on humans is ethical per se. But the point is, remember that even Dr. Fauci has said himself, numerous times that the testing they're doing with these PCR tests at the current threshold they're using is not accurate.
Evolving into a bit of a standard that if you get a cycle threshold of 35 or more, that the chances of it being replication competent are minuscule. Mm. So that if somebody, and you know, we have patients, and it's very frustrating for the patients as well as for the physicians. Somebody comes in and they repeat their PCR and it's like 37 cycle threshold. But you almost never can culture virus from a 37 threshold cycle. So I think if somebody does come in with 37, 38, even 36, you got to say, you know, it's just.
Now, I've shown that clip numerous times. And what he's saying right there is that the threshold, which is generally 35 to 40 in almost every place in this country, every place as far as I can tell, it's not working. It's minuscule, to use his own word. So you're not actually getting the results that you need. So the question should immediately be, why then is everybody using that test with that same threshold? Because understand, here's another part that's even crazier to me, right? So if he's literally telling you right now that that's how that you get an inaccurate result based on that threshold of the test, if there's even a possibility that this test could be used in a way that's not accurate, why wasn't there an immediate nationwide mandate set down to say, here's how these tests need to be used? Nobody should be over 35 threshold. That still hasn't happened. Dr. Fauci said that in July, I believe. So I think it's safe to assume that somebody at some level wants this illusion to be happening. I mean, how can you argue otherwise? If he said that, and he's the leader of this coronavirus task force, why wouldn't they immediately put it out and say, everybody should be using 30 threshold, period? But they don't. He admits himself in that same interview that people are using all different thresholds at different locations, and anything over 35 is a guarantee that you're going to get a high prevalence of false positives. And he is, if you look at most of them, almost all of them are 37 into 40. That's why he says that. It never changed. I mean, a whole video about this saying it's about the pandemic that wasn't. And I'm going to get into that in a second again to reference one more time the epidemic that wasn't and how it used the PCR test. And that's how they got the fake epidemic of whooping cough in 2007, I believe. But apparently we can't learn our lessons from our own history in this country. Or we do learn our lessons and we go, ooh, I can use that in the future for some kind of psyop. But it says, On the one hand, the petitioners demand that due to the known lack of accuracy, the PCR test in a serious study. Oh, I read that part. So basically, they're saying they don't work and that they need to use the style of test that I believe includes like a blood sample and so on that is per person needs to happen no matter what. Now, it said they list a few things in here that are concerns, but these two stood out to me. The mRNA vaccine from BioNTech Pfizer contain, this is really interesting, polyethylene glycol, I believe, or PEG. 70% of the people who 70% of people develop antibodies against that substance. That this means, they say, that many people can develop allergic, potentially fatal reactions to the vaccination. So if this vaccine, which it does, contains polyethylene glycol, and 70% of people who take that develop an antibody against it, that means that 70% of these people have a seemingly high chance of developing allergic or potentially fatal reactions. This is from renowned scientists. But who cares, right? Because we're in danger. Don't worry about your safety because we're in danger. I laugh at that every time I talk about this stuff. We're rushing through safety trials for your safety. That's what this all boils down to. It's dumb. But it says the much too short duration of the study does not allow a realistic estimation of the late effects that they're going to monitor in your body. It says, as in the narcolepsy cases after the swine flu vaccination. I love how they state that, right? But they in the mainstream article, they reference that same swine flu vaccination as a positive. But there was narcolepsy issues after that. And it says millions of healthy people would be exposed to an unacceptable risk if an emergency approval were to be granted and the possibility of observing the late effects of the vaccinations were to follow. Nevertheless, BioNTech and Pfizer apparently submitted the application for the emergency approval on December 1st. Doesn't matter. No one's even going to respond to these people, despite the fact that they have every reason to, credentials and otherwise. as well as the fact that an increasing number of renowned scientists are calling this out. Oh, excuse me, as I do that again. Really just reading over the same document here. But it's really crazy. This part I want you to remember. 70% of people develop antibodies against the polyethylene glycol, I believe is how it's pronounced. This means that many people can develop allergic, potentially fatal reactions to the vaccination. I mean, that's incredible. That alone, if you can just have a fatal reaction because of this thing they have in their vaccine, and it's specifically the mRNA vaccine, if that's even possible, how can you be forced to take it, or at the very least be pressured into, which, by the way, again, is also against international law because you cannot be forced by disadvantage or prejudice. But we don't care about the law in this government, I should say, doesn't care about the law. But here's another point. Right, as we're talking about this, and these doctors are saying, "Don't do this," or "Don't you shouldn't do it this way," because it's putting people in danger. But they're all, that's fake news, though, right? Unless it's a doctor that agrees with the mainstream media, then they're a fake news doctor that doesn't believe in science. Just parrot, listen. That's all they want from you. Just nod your head and pay attention to mainstream media. Don't think at all. Here's a vaccine damage payment document. This is from the gov.uk. I just found this to be ridiculous. Someone just sent me this today. I actually don't even think this is new. I believe this has been around. A lot of these documents on these gov sites don't have dates or anything, but this, I believe this has been there from before the COVID-19 scandal illusion. Vaccine damage payment. Look at what this says. If you get hurt from this vaccine, which it already says 15% will have pretty significant noticeable issues, and that this document is saying that 70% of people could potentially have a fatal response to it. Sounds like a lot going on there. If you're severely disabled, just commonly happen, you know, if you're disabled from this vaccine, no biggie. If you're severely disabled as a result of a vaccination against certain diseases, you could get, I love that, a one-off tax-free payment of 120,000 euro. This is called a vaccine damage payment. But I thought vaccines never hurt anybody though, right? Obviously, we know that's not true. That's why it's so stupid when they try to argue that it's fake news, that there's issues with vaccines ever. But for pointing this out, they call you anti-vaxxer. It's just stupid. The same reductive idea that everything in mainstream media is you're either left or you're right. You're either this or you're that. It's all reduced down to two ridiculous things that are usually when there's 1,000 things in between. Effect on benefits you'll receive. So this is what I couldn't believe. So you get disabled from a vaccine that they give you. In this case, possibly one that you're pressured into taking. So you get disabled, you might be able to get extra money. But if you are able to squeeze that money out of them after they did disable you, you also then have to consider that, well, it might conflict with your other payments. A vaccine damage payment can affect other benefits. And this is something that happened. My dad went through this recently, which I couldn't believe. He has his retirement and all these other things that he's been saving all these years. And guess what? He retires. And they say, well, you can't really have both. One takes out of the other. But wait a minute. He put money into both of those things separately. That money's there. Then not only do they tell you that one pulls from the other, but they also say that they're going to tax it again. So they pay you that money. They tax it. Then you retire and you're supposed to get that money that you've been letting them hold. And they tax you on it again. And they pull from other things. You can be disabled by a vaccine and they'll say, well, we're going to give you $120,000, but it's going to pull away from your child tax credit and your universal credit. You know, it might anyway. How is that even possible? That shouldn't conflict with anything. If you just got disabled from something they gave you, you shouldn't be like, well, it's also going to conflict with your taxes. It should just be a straight up money payment because, I mean, it should be more than that anyway. Are we going to pretend like $120,000 is enough to just say, you're good. You disabled my child for life. But yeah, that's good. Give me some money. The fact that these things even exist shows you what's really happening. And as well as the fact that we're saying they're all, you know, already talking about giving kids as young as 11 years old the ability to consent for themselves about vaccines. We won't let them drive a car, won't let them drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes or join the military or really do anything except, you know, get a sex change and get vaccines. Anybody confused about that? There's a reason those two things are there, because it's politicized. All of it. You cannot argue that a kid can't drive a car and join the military or smoke cigarettes, but he can alter his sexual, his biology for the rest of his life before he even understands what he wants to do with his life or what he see. I mean, a child does not under, children do what they think looks cool or looks trendy, or they want to be like other people. And so as we're forcing this all in their perception, We can see how this influences what they decide they want to do. But sure, let's let them do that when they're children. Let's let them inject themselves with something that is potentially dangerous because they've been convinced by whatever teacher they're in front of or whatever media they're watching that this is the right thing to do. What happens when then they get hurt? Does the child then petition the government because they superseded their parents' decisions? Well, certainly they have to then. Suddenly we've got children in courts talking with governments. This is stupid. There's no way you can say that this makes sense, but it's happening anyway. Here's the actual documentation from the District of Columbia, minor consent for vaccinations amendment. Now, it started in 2019, but what I wanted to show is that it kind of just stalled after June 2019 and then just kicked right back into gear in October, I wonder why, of 2020. Now, here's a really important part that I want you guys to make sure that you read for yourselves, spread around. The BMJ, right? One of these huge publications for scientific studies that is important, that is, you know, again, one of the sources that we're told, like one of the, you know, as opposed to going to some fringe site, we're talking about a direct study from this. This just really blows my mind. I talked about this, I don't know, 10 times. I talked about the Forbes article. I talked about the individual locations of Moderna, of Pfizer, and so on. And people flipped out. Said, you're misunderstanding. This is what you don't know, as usual, as always. But here's the BMJ coming out with it on October 21st. I wish I would have seen this back in October. I don't know how I missed this. But it says, will COVID-19 vaccines save lives? Current trials aren't designed to tell us. What a joke. Even mainstream scientific publications are saying that these so-called safety trials are not actually designed to tell us if they're safe. And yet they're talking about forcing this, paying people, you know, socially applying pressure to anybody to do. I mean, it's incredible. Look at what this says. The world has bet the farm on vaccines as the solution to the pandemic, but the trials are not focused on answering any questions many might assume they are, according to Peter Doshi. Now, understand what they're telling you here is that this is all about gaining herd immunity, right? Herd immunity will, and basically saying that we will not get this unless we get most people in this country doing it. They just kept driving that home. Now, let me show you why they're openly saying that that's not even on the table. As phase three trials of COVID-19 vaccines reach their target enrollments, officials have been trying to project calm. The U.S. coronavirus czar Anthony Fauci and the, it's so strange how that continues to be used, and the Food and Drug Administration leadership have offered public assurances that established procedures will be followed. Only a safe and effective vaccine will be approved, they say. And 9 vaccine manufacturers issued a rare joint statement pledging not to prematurely seek regulatory review. And then they all just did that. Right? I love that because they use the word prematurely. And if you try to address them on that, they'll argue it wasn't prematurely. We got 90% effectiveness with 160 people, but who cares? They sign a joint statement to not do what they're doing now and then do it anyway. It says, but what will it mean exactly when a vaccine is declared effective? To the public, this seems fairly obvious. And I've already covered this. The primary goal of a COVID-19 vaccine is to keep people from getting very sick and dying. That's an NPR broadcast. It's not true. That's the idea. That's what they want you to think is about to happen. And that's what they'll get. If you press them on this, they'll end up saying, well, that's what we're going to be doing. This one's just the first version. That's, wait for it. That's going to happen. Because someone along the line, even in mainstream circles, is going to fall backward into this and realize after they see our show or something that, wait a minute, this isn't even meant to give you immunity. It's not even meant to stop people from getting sick. And then they're going to point it out. The media will talk about it when it's allowed to be talked about. And then all of a sudden the excuse will be that no, this was the first version of it. And it's just going to be able to reduce your sickness. But the next one's coming very soon, even though they're no longer testing because they already got their emergency use authorization. And it goes on and on and on. But NPR either doesn't know that or is lying to you. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Bayer College of Medicine in Houston said, quote, ideally, you want an antiviral vaccine to do 2 things. First, reduce the likelihood you will get severely ill and go to the hospital. And 2, prevent infection and therefore interrupt disease transmission. I argue that second part is the only thing they're talking about. They're talking about vaccines to go back to normal. They're talking about reducing transmission and flattening the curve. That's the only thing we're being driven to, reducing the spread of this virus. This vaccine will not do that. It says, yet the current phase three trials are not actually set up to prove either. So let's put it this way, to be more specific. They're not shown to do that in any way, which means if they're claiming they are, it's just a simple guess. They've not been proven to do that. And again, I'm saying that to be as middle ground, you know, trying to be as specific as possible, but their own documentation before they even started the trials very clearly said that their goal was about lessening symptoms. That's it. It was not about it. So they weren't even trying to reach this. So why then is NPR and NIH and all the media telling you otherwise? You know why. It says none of the trials currently underway are designed to detect a reduction in any serious outcome, such as hospital admissions, use of intensive care, or deaths. Yeah, we don't care about that, right? Nor are the vaccines being studied to determine whether they can interrupt transmission of the virus. There you go. From a reputable scientific outlet that's straight up telling you the truth. It says, quote, we're not, and this is in evaluating mild, not severe disease. It says, quote, we're not talking about just a PCR positive mild infection. It has to be moderate to severe illness to qualify as an event, correct? He's asking this in an interview to the person in regard involved with the program. Basically saying that, so you're not just taking, you know, a PCR telling you someone's sick and then using that as a case, right? Because, by the way, we know that's what's happening. But he responds, that's right. Paul Offit, a vaccinologist who sits on the FDA advisory committee that may ultimately recommend the vaccines for license and emergency use authorization, despite the fact that the FDA is not even allowed at the table in the discussions of Operation Warp Speed, as Whitney showed on the show. Sure, let's make, they'll know what they're told to say, but it says, but that's not right. Right? So he goes, yeah, that's right. But it's not. In all the ongoing phase three trials, all of them, for which details have been released, laboratory confirmed infections, even with only mild symptoms, qualify as meeting the primary endpoint definition. So basically somebody has the sniffles and test positive PCR, that's counted as a case. Meaning that some of these people that they say it worked on might not have even had it. It says in Pfizer and Moderna trials, for example, people with only a cough and positive laboratory tests would bring those trials even closer to their completion. If AstraZeneca's ongoing UK trial is designed similarly to its paused US trial for which the company has released details, a cough and fever with positive PCR test would suffice. Meaning he lied. Period. Or, you know, I mean, look, but I'm going to stick with that because when this was asked, it was at a time when it was very aware that that's the way this was going. I read that on numerous documents way back then. So he knew that too. And so did all the media that continue to parrot that this is going to happen. It's going to reach herd immunity and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You need to do it for everyone's safety. No, it's not though. Seems like an important thing to mention. It says severe illness requiring hospital admission, which happens in only a small fraction of symptomatic COVID-19 cases, would be unlikely to occur in significant numbers in trials. Now, I'm going to circle back to make a point here, but I want you to hear what she's saying there. And this is exactly what I keep saying. Whether they had 30,000, 100,000, how many people that they had, it only boiled down to, as we know, 160 cases, which we just told you that could mean just a cough and a PCR test. So they may not even actually have that. It should, the point they're saying is it should be severe cases. It should be people that are obviously sick and obviously severe case. And that is how you prove this is working. They didn't do that. That would be unlikely to occur in significant numbers in these trials. Data published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in late April reported a symptomatic case hospitalization ratio of 3.4% overall. Doesn't that sound like a familiar percentage? Varying from 1.7 to from in 1 to 49 or 0 to 49 years old and 4.5% in 50 to 64 years old, 7.4 in those 65 and over. Now, this is only specifically reported symptomatic hospitalizations. Now, it says because most people with symptomatic COVID-19 experience only mild symptoms, even trials involving 30,000 or more patients would turn up relatively few cases of severe disease. In the trials, final efficacy analyses are planned after just 150 to 160 events, exactly like we've been reporting. That is, a positive indication of symptomatic COVID-19, regardless of severity of the illness. Meaning, it is not even doing what they're claiming it's doing. On top of that, it is not even designed to stop you from spreading or catching. But let me revisit this real quick. I want you, I'd say this, I almost missed this when I was reading through it. Realize what this is saying. From this October reputable scientific study posting website that says severe illness requiring hospital admission, which happens in only a small fraction of symptomatic COVID-19 cases. Okay, so if only a very small fraction of COVID-19 cases end up with severe illness, how does that mean we're in a pandemic? Am I crazy? Like, that literally says that it's not, it says severe illness requiring hospital admission, which only happens in a small fraction of symptomatic COVID-19 cases, would be unlikely to occur. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't that sound like they're saying we're not really in danger? Okay, let's go forward. It says data published by the CDC reported a symptomatic case hospitalization ratio of 3.4 overall, which again was that's the death rate they told us in the beginning. That was not true. Remember, 3.4%. Just find that interesting. But it says this is the best part, because most people who are showing symptoms of COVID-19 experience only mild symptoms. What? That doesn't sound like, I mean, that's the opposite of what we would be in. They're telling you that only a very small grouping of people even show serious symptoms, and even a small percentage of those people even end up getting sick in the hospital. That's crazy. It says even trials over 30,000 would relatively few cases of severe disease, meaning that you have a hard time finding severe cases of the disease, even in 30,000 people. What? I mean, this is just so frustrating how clear this stuff is, and this won't even be addressed because there's nothing they can really attack here. This is all very fundamentally clear, and the science and the evidence is easy to look up, but that's why you will not hear it talked about, because these people, not this one, in this case, specifically the authors on this site, but the people in mainstream media that are continuing to lie to you about whatever they're told to lie about. It just blows my mind. But it says in the trials, 150 to 160 events, exactly like we told you. It says vaccine manufacturers, of course, did little to dispel the notion that it was severe COVID-19 that the trials were assessing. So they lied. They sort of like the U.S. government never said it was Iraq responsible for 9/11, but clearly continued to insinuate that Iraq was responsible for 9/11. And that's why the vast majority of Americans thought that Iraq was responsible for 9/11. There's not a secret there. It's propaganda. So what they're doing is they're hoping that you infer from what they're saying that it's going to give you immunity, because they keep screaming how we all need to get this for immunity. But that's not true. Moderna, for example, called hospital admissions a key secondary endpoint in statements to the media. And a press release from the U.S. from the NIH reinforced that impression, stating that Moderna's trials, quote, aims to study whether the vaccine can prevent severe COVID-19 and, quote, seeks to answer if the vaccine can prevent death caused by COVID-19. But Zal Tax, who we've mentioned before, chief medical officer of Moderna, told this publication, the BMJ, that the company's trial lacks adequate statistical power to assess those outcomes. So they lied. That's interesting. The trial is precluded from judging hospital admissions based on what is a reasonable size and duration to serve the public good here. Talk about a political response. Wait, I thought this guy was working for Moderna. Sounds like a politician. Yeah, because they're pretty much one and the same today. This trial is precluded from judging based on what is reasonable size and duration. That's ridiculous. Just answer the damn question. Right. The point, what he's saying is what he gets into next is basically what he's boiling it down to is, if we really wanted to find these things out, we would need more money and a bigger trial. But that's not my job. That's what that basically boils down to. So we're trying not to find these things out, but it's because we're in danger. Again, lessening your safety because of your safety. This is just so stupid. But it says hospital admissions and deaths from COVID-19 are simply too uncommon in the population. Again, yes. Because we're not really in danger, it would seem. Again, hospital admissions and deaths from COVID-19 are simply too uncommon in the population being studied for an effective vaccine to demonstrate statistically significant differences in a trial of 30,000 people. The same is true of its ability to save lives or prevent transmission. The trials are not designed to find out. That's incredible to me. It says, and this is about stopping transmission, which is really what they want you to think is going to happen. What about HOTS's second criterion, interrupting virus transmission, which some experts have argued should be the most important test? That's the only thing that people are talking about right now. It says, quote, our trial will not demonstrate prevention of transmission. That's directly from the chief medical officer of Moderna, Tal Zaks. So if it's not preventing transmission and it's not stopping you from getting severely sick, is that not what I just told you before? So you can still spread this, and people who had the vaccine can still catch it. That's what that means. But when you do catch it, though, so they say, you'll just have a little bit less of symptoms. So that means that we'll just continue to take this vaccine for the rest of our lives, right? I wonder if that's going to change. I wonder if they dive into the research and make sure we can only take one forever. It's sort of like deciding that, well, we have a business model here that's going to continue to give out money, but we're going to just change that and make one that they only need to buy one forever. What business will ever do that? And that's the point we're always showing you, that they make sure these things are, I mean, it's the same reason that they have your iPhone will systematically break down. Planned obsolescence, right? It's not a secret. Our trial will not demonstrate the prevention of transmission. Gosh darn it, I can't get that highlight. There we go. Because in order to do that, you have to swab people twice a week for very long periods, and that becomes operationally untenable. Oh, we'll see. So it just, like, I think, so if we were trying to stop transmission and there was a way that you could test and find that out, why aren't we doing that? Of course, the argument will be because we have to rush this out because you're in danger. But we're not, though. But that doesn't even make sense. Why rush it out under the guise that it will stop this thing if it's not even actually going to stop this thing? It's probably not even really there. Think about how crazy that is. The logic does not make sense. It is a fallacy. But it's not his fault, though. We just don't have the ability to. It's just a large, and he says right here, added that 30,000 participant trial is already a fairly large trial. If you're asking for a 300,000 trial, well, you need to talk to the people who are paying for it. Ah, I see. So it's the government's fault, as usual. So if the government wanted to pay for a bigger trial with more, I mean, the argument is that we have to do this for your safety. But the safety is about finding out how it actually stops this thing within their own narrative, right? But they chose not to pay for that. This is the kind of thing you need to remember. Because it's a clear trail to show. There's a choice that was made here. It says, and I think the public purse and operational capabilities and capacities we have are rightly spent not betting the farm on one vaccine. But as Operation Warp Speed, the U.S. government's COVID vaccine plan is trying to do, make sure that we're funding several vaccines in parallel. Oh, I see. So we don't want to spend the extra money, but we're willing to spend money on multiple vaccines of which we're only going to use one. That's the same paragraph. So if we spent the extra money, but less in total, on one vaccine to make sure that it actually stopped transmission, that would be betting the farm on one that might not pan out. But we're going to spend more money on multiple vaccines and only do smaller testing. Because clearly the safety is not what they're concerned about. It's getting the vaccine to production and use. Please tell me that makes sense. Because if it was about the safety, well, that would be what they focus on. But it's not. Safety and side effects. History shows many examples of serious adverse events from vaccines brought to market in periods of enormous pressure and expectation. We know this, even though they continue to argue that that's not the case. History shows us we have numerous examples of not just serious adverse events. Well, I guess death is considered a serious adverse event from vaccines because they're brought to market through pressure and expectation like right now. There were contaminated polio vaccines in 1955, cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, I think I'm always mispronouncing that, in recipients of the flu vaccines in 1976. That was the first swine flu lie, which we played that video for you more than once. And narcolepsy linked to one brand of influenza vaccine in 2009, and the other H1N1 lie. But we're supposed to pretend like that'll never happen, right? Because historically speaking, when we've rushed things out, we always have problems. Finding severe rare adverse events will require the study of tens of thousands of patients. Yeah. But this requirement will not be met by early adoption of a product that has not completed its full trial evaluation, Harvard drug policy researchers. So it won't happen because they want to force it out quickly. That's why. COVID-19 vaccine trials are currently designed to tabulate final efficacy results once just 150 to 160 trial participants develop symptomatic COVID-19. And that is using PCR test and small symptoms, which means they might not even have it. And most trials have specified at least one interim analysis, allowing for the trials to end with even fewer data accrued. Sure, because it's all about you, right? Medscape's Eric Topol has been a vocal critic of the trials, many interim analyses. He says, quote, "These numbers seem totally out of line with what would be considered stopping rules." He says, "I mean, you're talking about giving a vaccine with any of these programs to tens of millions of people, and you're going to base that on 100 events? Remember, events that might not even actually be events." Yes, they are. Again, for your safety. Continue to realize how that makes no sense at all. Moderna, like Pfizer and Janssen, has designed its study to detect a relative risk reduction of at least 30% in participants developing laboratory-confirmed COVID-19, consistent with FDA international guidelines. I also find it interesting that they designed the test to detect a relative risk reduction of at least 30%, and the CDC is claiming that the PCR test has a 30% false positive rate. It says, but the test is that the science remains far from clear-cut. Even for influenza vaccines that have been used for decades. That's the BMJ saying that. You're not even allowed to float that idea that the vaccine, that the influenza vaccines don't work at all. They even slightly don't work and you're an anti-vaxxer conspiracy theorist. This is from a scientific study that is straight up telling you the truth is that the science remains far from clear cut, even for influenza vaccines that have been used for decades. Although randomized trials have shown an effect in reducing the risk of symptomatic influenza, such trials have never been conducted in elderly people living in the community to see whether they save lives. You mean the focal point of these vaccines, the elderly, in regard to influenza, they've never tested them on the very people that they're pushing to get them? You know what that sounds like to me? The same thing we talked about back with the MMR vaccine and the fact that they refused to test vax versus unvaxxed because that's the one thing that could show whether or not their claims were true, and they refused to do it. Why in the world would we continue to push flu vaccines on the very people that we were never tested them on? I mean, it's ridiculous. Or the fact that they're injecting multiple vaccines which at a very young age in a children they have not tested together. Guys, that is basic stuff. And we're crazy for even bringing it up. It says only two placebo-controlled trials in this population have ever been conducted, and neither was designed to detect any difference in hospital admissions or deaths. Because it's all about treating you sickly and keeping you in that state. Moreover, dramatic increases in use of influenza vaccines has not been associated with a decline in mortality. Now, on top of what I just said, remember that there's always this overarching push for And this is not conspiracy theory. The idea that people have openly advocated that we need to lessen the population is a fact. Now, I'm not saying that means they're going to go out and murder a bunch of people. It could mean that. But it means that they feel that it makes sense and it's in everyone's best interest to lower the population. And if they believe that that was in the best interest and it needed to happen now, who's to say what they would do? Not enrolling enough elderly people or minorities, right? The very two things that they say that historically speaking and statistically are always affected more. So they're not enrolling enough elderly or minorities in the test for the major people that they're going to make this. I mean, they already talked about giving it to minorities first, but they're not enrolling enough of them to make sure that it actually affects them different or the same or so on. Just how does that make sense to anybody? This is a really important study that I really want people to read and digest. Now, finishing off here, I wanted to include this because I just thought this was really fascinating, especially since we're talking about the idea of the technocratic rise, the mixing biology with technology, and the fact that all of this seems to be leading in that direction. Remember, we just talked about this. The SPARS pandemic of 2025. I'll have to remember to put Derek's article in there. Actually, here, let me just grab it real quick because I will forget. A great article that you really need to read. The SPARS pandemic of 2025, echo chambers and vaccine opposition. Now, this is a study that was done by Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and this is about a pandemic that's supposed to happen in 2025. You know, simulation, though, like all the other ones that ended up coming to life. But this is talking about a vaccine that's called CoroVax. This is real. This is Jefferson's researchers develop an investigational vaccine for COVID-19. Okay, this is new. and it's called CoroVax. Okay. So in this document of the prediction of this, which was in 2017, and Derek's the one that showed me this, their vaccine was called CoroVax. So you're telling me that yet again, in a simulation from 2017, which I make sure I'm not misstating the date. I know it's previous. Let me just make sure. Where did I just see it? I just looked before we started. Shoot. Anyway, well, the point being, I always hate that when I can't remember exactly. Prior is the point. Okay, so nonetheless, it just drives me crazy when I can't find it what I'm looking for. All right, it's not popping up, but it looks like okay, well, let's just say prior, without the exact date. So we're talking about CoroVax coming out in March, the actual vaccine that they hypothetically discuss in this document. And then remember, this is a hypothetical about a future pandemic, that they use the CoroVax vaccine. Well, I don't think it's, but afterward is the point. So March 12th, 2020 is when this was incorporated. So they actually create a company called CoroVax that creates vaccines. And I just find that ridiculous. The same way that the Invent 201 discussed a hypothetical disease that later was used, and they used the same name they used in that 201 simulation. Right? I forget what was that, the first one, it was like 2019 COV2 or something like that. I mean, the first thing they used, that was what they called it in the Event 201 simulation, and then later used that exact name. So here's another example of them saying, this is something we're predicting for 2025, and then they actually make the name. I mean, it's just silly. It shows you, I mean, why would a company choose to make that? Or do that. It's just in the ether and they just happened to grab it, or that they knew for some reason, or they used it because it tied in with something they knew was coming, or I don't know. But it's very crazy to continue to see these things where they go, we never thought planes would fly in a building. And then exactly that happens, where on the day of 9/11, they're theorizing about planes and happening. There's so many examples of how they predict things that later happen, or they're simulating things that later happen exactly the way they said they would, or that they're in the middle of a simulation right when the actual thing ends up happening. That's happened too. So get ready for CoroVax to be a relevant discussion in the years to come. But to finish with the PCR test discussion, because that obviously is a really big point about the illusion of all this. A global team of experts has found 10 fatal flaws in the main test for COVID and is demanding that it's urgently axed. I have been talking about this from the moment that I started researching PCR. As always, a nod to John Rappaport, because he's the one that was really nailing this home when he's the first person I saw talking about this. It's very easy to see. A peer review of a paper, which I believe I have right there. I'll include this as always for you to read for yourself. A peer review of the paper on which most COVID testing is based has comprehensively debunked the science behind it, finding major flaws, the PCR test. They conclude it's utterly unsuitable as a means for diagnosis, and the fallout is immense. This will be ignored by the entirety of Western media. This is huge. Now, even the author reports about the same thing we just talked about. Last week, he also reported on the landmark ruling from Portugal, the Lisbon Court, where that court ruled against a government health authority that had illegally confined 4 people to a hotel this summer. They had done so because one of the people had tested positive for COVID in a PCR test, but the court had found that the test fundamentally flawed and basically inadmissible. That is from the court. That's a huge precedent, and that was also ignored. Now the PCR testing supremacy under which we all now live has received another crushing blow. A peer review, from a group of 22 international experts has found 10 major flaws in the main protocol for such tests. This is not a hypothetical. This is painfully clear. I've gone over all of this, and you can read for yourself. It's explicit. I mean, they go through step by step and show you all of the reasons this thing is not to be used the way it is. The report systematically dismantles the original study. I missed that first part. The peer review from a group of 22 national experts has found 10 major flaws in the protocol. I'm sorry. It says it right afterward. I read these all earlier, then I'm getting it mixed up. The report systematically dismantles the original study called the Corman-Drosten paper, which described a protocol for applying PCR technique to detect COVID. So that's a paper that was parroted and used by all the media to say, see, this is the one we should be using. Nothing that has come out since, despite very clearly showing that stuff isn't true, has changed it, because it's not about the truth. It's about the narrative. It says the Corman-Drosten paper was published on January 23rd. Interesting timing, right? Charles Lieber, the whole thing, the tarting of all this, just a day after being submitted, which would make any peer review process that took place possibly the shortest in history. One day turnaround. Is that because it was real or right, or because it was the PCR test, which was the one that was the plan? What is important about it is that the protocol it describes is used around 70% of COVID kits worldwide. Right, that's the same thing we're telling you. 37 to 40 threshold PCR test. It's fast, it's cheap, and it's absolutely useless, according to this article, which I happen to agree with in regard to what we're dealing with. The 10 deadly sins, as it says, among the fatal flaws that totally invalidate the PCR testing protocol are that the test is nonspecific due to erroneous primer design, is enormously variable, cannot discriminate between the whole virus and the viral fragments. That's the whole story right there. Has no positive or negative controls. Has no standard operating procedure. Yeah, you don't say. That's incredible. The fact that that's not a big deal. No standard operating. So some guy could just do it with what? I mean, there's no standard operating procedure for how to correctly apply this, and it's being used freely to gather numbers and claim this is happening. Does not seem to have been properly peer-reviewed. It says, one wonders whether anything at all was correct in this paper, but wait, it gets worse. As has been noted previously, no threshold for positivity was ever identified. This is why labs have been running 40 cycles, almost guaranteeing a large number of false positives, up to 97%, according to some studies. I'll include that as well. The cherry on top, though, is that among the authors of the original paper themselves, get this, at least four have severe conflicts of interest. Who didn't see that coming? Two of them are members of the editorial board of Eurosurveillance, the sinisterly named journal that published the paper. And at least three of them are on the payroll of the first companies to perform PCR testing. Gee, so that's called a profit motive. I wonder if that drove their decisions. And everyone after this that continued to tear this apart has been ignored because this one says so. Unbelievable. I mean, it's totally believable, but I just am blown away. Oh, where were we? Right here. Now, this brings us to the point that I'm only going to read one part of this, but I've read this a few times. I can't get past how we can be in a position where we can have this happen, where we have experts calling this out. And I've been saying this from the beginning, and plenty of people that have been involved with the PCR test before COVID have also spoken up and said, no, there's no way that's going to be used for this or that. It doesn't give you false positives and so on. All of this is everything we're talking about, from the numbers, from the illusion of everything. I mean, literally every part of this story comes to a head when you read what happened in 2007. The idea, not that it's, I mean, look, I do think that there's nefarious agendas happening here. I very clearly think, whether it was created and used or just being used after it's here, right now, it is beyond question that there are people abusing this for their own agendas, own ends. So the possibility that this is simply happening by and large, other than those people I'm talking about, by just a misunderstanding, is actually not that far-fetched. In this case, in 2007, these people for 8 months thought, in a huge area, thought they were dealing with a whooping cough epidemic. Why was that? Because they used a PCR test. Now it says right here, 4 months, nearly everyone involved thought the medical center had had a huge whooping cough outbreak with expensive ramifications. I'll just start right here. This is in Dartmouth Medical Center. She could not stop coughing for 2 weeks, starting in mid-April, seemingly nonstop, followed by another week when she coughed sporadically. Before long, an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth had a chilling thought. Could she be seeing the start of a whooping cough epidemic? By late April, other people there started coughing as well. And because it had the hallmark sound that they thought, which is not a wrong thing to consider, they thought, okay, this might be whooping cough. And then if it was whooping cough, the epidemic had to be contained immediately because the disease could be deadly to babies, hospitals could lead to pneumonia and the frail, and on and on and on. Which led to the start of a bizarre episode. The story of the epidemic that wasn't. So, for months, nearly everyone involved thought the medical center had had a huge whooping cough outbreak with extensive ramifications. Nearly 1,000 healthcare workers at the hospital in Lebanon, New Hampshire, were given a preliminary test and furloughed from work until their results were in. 142 people, including Dr. Herndon, were told they appeared to have the disease. Thousands were given antibiotics and a vaccine for protection. Thousands of people that they didn't need. Hospital beds were taken out of commission, including some in intensive care. Remember, this didn't happen. To some level, these people were just taken with what was happening in front of them. Whether that's from their superiors telling them, the test they were using, the symptoms they thought they saw, all these things combined to convince them that it was happening, but it really wasn't happening. So you can see that it's not always some grand thing where everybody's involved, but more how they know how to manipulate people's trust in authority. Then, about 8 months later, talk about relevant to where we are now. Healthcare workers were dumbfounded to receive an email message from the hospital administration, simply informing them that the whole thing was a false alarm. Not a single case, not one case of whooping cough was confirmed with the definitive test, which is what we should be doing, growing the bacterium, which is in this case pertussis, which is whooping cough, in the laboratory. Instead, it appears the healthcare workers probably were affected with ordinary respiratory diseases like the common cold, which, by the way, is also a coronavirus. But what they're saying there, and by the way, what people like John Rappaport have always been saying is that they should be testing this, and that's why it's never been isolated, because that's never happened. They haven't actually done this and confirmed that this is what's causing the problem, or that the problem's even there, or that, you know, on and on and on. It hasn't happened. Koch's postulates was not met. But it says, instead, it appeared the healthcare workers probably were infected with just common cold. Now, as they looked back on the episode, epidemiologists, after 8 months plus of this, they look back. Epidemiologists and infectious disease specialists say the problem was that they placed too much faith in a quick and highly sensitive molecular test that led them astray. Funny how that was the consensus opinion. Nobody did that. We all see it now. But you're not even allowed to talk about that today, right? You can't even suggest for a moment that maybe, the same thing that happened then is possibly happening now, or maybe, in fact, more specifically, is being used now because they saw it then. Yes, I'm a conspiracy theorist. I know. Conspiracy realist, in fact. But it says, at Dartmouth, the decision was to use a test, the PCR, for polymerase chain reaction. It is a molecular test that, until recently, was confined to molecular biology laboratories. Now it says, the Dartmouth whooping cough story shows what can ensue. To say the episode was disruptive was an understatement. It says, you cannot imagine. I had a feeling at the time that this gave us a shadow of a hint of what might be like during a pandemic. Flu pandemic. So she literally felt like she was in the middle of a serious pandemic. People were panicking. People were coming and getting tested. People were getting vaccines. They're locking down beds. It didn't happen, guys. How do we not see how that relates to what's literally happening now? Or at the very least, possibly. It says, epidemiologists say it's one of the most troubling aspects of the pseudo-epidemic is that all the decisions seem so sensible at the time. A medical epidemiologist at the Funeral Center for Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention, who worked on the case alongside them, so you know, CDC was involved, HHS was involved. Maybe this was a test run. They don't fault the doctors. The issue was not that they overreacted or did anything inappropriate. Instead, it's that there was no way to decide early on whether an epidemic is underway. So we're supposed to wait 9 months and give vaccines before we suddenly find out? No. But that's what they want you to think. The point is, guys, as they say, this is something that has been happening, something that could be happening, something that, I mean, is not new. That's what I just cannot get past, is this is something that they're telling us is likely to continue. And this is in 2007. They say that the article goes on to talk about the idea that this is likely the largest example, but clearly not the only one. And they openly talk about how in 2007, this is a real problem that we need to get a handle on. And then nobody ever talks about it again. I wonder why. That's called the epidemic that wasn't. As I said in my other video, we're living the pandemic that wasn't. As I just grab that real quick so I can make sure. I hope you guys have checked me out on Odyssey. Here it is. Just so I can include this so you guys can watch it. COVID delusion. How COVID-19 testing and mainstream media hype is creating a pandemic that wasn't. And I go over that full document so you guys can read it more if you'd like to check it out. But to finish off here, of course, all that said, all the facts and information I'm showing you sourced right from the people they're supposed to be talking, here's what they have to say about it. There's no vaccine for the infodemic. Of course, again, jumping all the way back to the beginning of how they tie in the idea of vaccines, viruses with the cyber concept. Like basically this is a vaccine for misinformation, right? The new virus is misinformation. So that's the point. They're continuing to kind of conflate the technological aspect with the biological aspect, even in analogies. So how can we combat the virus of misinformation? Fake news about COVID-19 and its origins, treatment and prevention has gone viral. Oh, you mean like the discussion of its origins, like the fact that it might have started in 2019 that we were censored for, and that's fake news, but then they say it on the mainstream media, so now it's okay? Like that? Exactly like that. The UN has launched a counterattack. The United Nations is launching a counterattack against people like me? Does that sound normal? And they want you to help. Of course, they're talking about people like me, despite the fact that what I'm showing you is absolutely not fake news. And every single thing we're showing, and that's why we get censored. There are a dime a dozen people on YouTube right now that are bleeding all kinds of nonsense about COVID-19. They're still there. Why? Didn't they say that those people be deleted? The point is, it's about people actually giving you the truth, and that's the caveat. But it says, Sorryful founder, whoever this is the group we're talking about, says algorithms and human editors can help turn the tide. So we're going to censor you. What is spreading across the globe can be passed on unwittingly. You see how they're using the virus analogy? From one person to countless others is potentially deadly, yet can be stopped if everyone takes the right steps. Misinformation. The subject of the new episode, World versus Virus. Like, it's just incredible. Like, it just suddenly happens where we're all in this the virus is the new ISIS. I said that in the very beginning, and I will always stand by that. ISIS doesn't even matter anymore, according to the mainstream media. This is the new fear-mongering tactic that we're supposed to be on guard at and feared all the time. That just suddenly happened all of a sudden, starting in this year. This says, now here, guess what though? The World Economic Forum and the UN are starting their own podcast. Cool. I'm sure that will be really popular, but of course it will be parroted by all the mainstream, regardless of the fact that nobody will actually listen to it. It says, heard of the miracle cure for COVID that the mainstream doesn't want you to know, right? So they're trying to disparage the concept that maybe there's other things out there that could actually help. And of course, if I just say, you know, vitamin D has been shown to do things, vitamin C, all these different things, and, you know, I'm not telling you they're curing you, but that's how they'll frame me. Here's another conspiracy theorist saying this will cure. I didn't say that. But that's why they use the Alex Joneses of the world to give you that ridiculous, all extreme version of the real truth. So they can point to that extreme version and say, see, that's fake news, but that's not what we were doing. That's how counterintelligence and, you know, controlled opposition works. This is, or that the pandemic is in fact a plandemic, deliberately created to make someone a fortune or to subjugate the masses. Yeah, because that's not happening at all, right? No one's benefiting off of this thing. But see, that's what they want. That's the whole point, is they're pushing the idea that there's no plan around this. Now, look, arguing that this entire thing from top to bottom was completely organized and planned is something that is really not that hard to wrap your mind around with what we're looking at today. But Anybody honest is not straight up claiming that every aspect is there, because anybody honest can't prove all those things. But is anybody even questioning the fact that things like BlackRock, where they had a plan to basically take control of the Treasury and the Fed months before this ever started, and then they used COVID-19 to say that that's what they did it for? Or the fact that numerous other examples were created long before we ever got here that are now being driven in because of this? Like, it's impossible not to see how this is being used in a way that benefits them that has nothing to do with COVID-19. But of course, we're crazy, because the nuance is gone when it comes to mainstream media, and that's, they live in the black and white. It says, then you've come up against a virus of misinformation. Again, the virus of misinformation that has spread around the world as fast as the coronavirus itself. Oh, you mean so from 2013 to today? I think we're a little faster than that. But it says, in a world where social media is increasingly where most of us get so much of our information, which is why, by the way, the mainstream media is, you know, clumsily forcing its way into YouTube and everything, because they know that they lost. The mainstream media is pathetic, and nobody pays attention to them outside of the small percentage of people that they pretend make up the majority. That's the truth, by the way. I mean, it's very clear. That's why they have paywalls on their outlets now, because they're not succeeding. They're being subsidized, I'd argue, for the largest degree. But these entities are desperate for more. They need to continue to control the narrative. And if they wouldn't be forcing into YouTube if they were effectively controlling the narrative with mainstream media. Basic. But it says, in a world where social media is increasingly the most, where we get most of our information, and where we value freedom of speech as a cornerstone of democracy, and then go on to say, what can be done to combat that? So pretending they care about democracy, right? Well, there's the cornerstone of democracy. How are we going to censor these people? That's basically what they're saying. And it's just so funny. It's like they always give lip service was the word phrase I was looking for. Lip service to democracy, and then go, what we're going to censor because that's dangerous to our democracy. Perfect. Makes sense, right? Of course it does. Now we're going to end and finish back with the same thing that we started with. And I want you to think about this stuff in comparison to what we just went over, and ask yourself whether this whole great reset thing that doesn't exist, according to the mainstream media, is just a bunch of fake news, or there's a bit more going on here today. And I know you guys are always thinking critically, which is why you're here.
It is obvious that governments have to play a leading role in securing cybersecurity, but ultimately, cybersecurity is a challenge for all of us. It is important to use the COVID-19 crisis as a timely opportunity to reflect on the lessons the cybersecurity community can draw and improve our preparedness for a potential cyber pandemic.
The cyber pandemic. Right. So a digital pandemic, a cyber pandemic. Are we still of the mind that that's an analogy? Just a, you know, convenient analogy that makes you think about the virus that they want you to believe is consuming your life, even though it's not really. Or every other way that they're kind of playing this game about mixing the things, or just continuing forward with the fact that he is openly telling you, as we already played in the beginning, that the Great Reset will lead to a fusion of our physical, digital, and biological identity.
The revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities.
Not hard to misunderstand, guys. So if that's the case, right? Are we really of the mind that this is some kind of analogy, or are we leading to a point to where that is the next false flag, the next justification, the next manipulation, the next psychological operation, of which there have been countless examples in the history of this government? These technologies will operate within our own biology and change how we interface with the world. Smart dust, arrays of full computers with antennas, each much smaller than a grain of sand, can now organize themselves inside the body. But right, we're conspiracy theorists though, right? The point, guys, of this entire show is just to give you the opportunity to think about things that they simply won't allow you to look at, that they're telling you are off the table, fake news, can't discuss, can't even pretend are relevant to the conversation. So I want you to consider these things can research them, talk about them, understand that this is not fake news, and that as we move forward with this whole thing, these are becoming more and more relevant. And that's it. That's simply it, that we need to be willing to ask questions and consider the larger picture, especially since our government is more than capable of all the things we're talking about, and historically speaking, has pretty much done them before. So please help me get this out, as always, and spread this and talk about this and just have conversations with people about the information. Not trying to scream at them about what you're supposed to be thinking, but say, hey, this is pretty interesting, isn't it? What are your thoughts? You know, what do you think about that? Doesn't that contrast what we're hearing from the mainstream media? You know, just try to open up the conversation with people. Have intelligent debates about what's really happening that doesn't lead to red-faced screaming, which is what they want from us. Just think critically. Show a little deductive logic and realize that this is not new. It's not even very original. Thank you for being here. As always, question everything, including me. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
What if the experts are wrong? What if quarantining the healthy doesn't actually save lives? What if wearing a mask in public is not effective?
If you do not have a mask, you cannot ride public transportation, sir.
My name is Dr. Jeff Barkey, and I'm here representing thousands of physicians across the country whose voices are being silenced because we don't agree with the mainstream media and the experts who are telling us what to do.
Everything I've seen in the last 9 days, all the things that just don't make sense, the patients I'm seeing in front of me, the lungs I'm trying to improve, have led me to believe that COVID-19 is not this disease, and that we are operating under a medical paradigm that is untrue.
Never in the history of this great republic have we quarantined the healthy. Never in the history of this great republic have we told churchgoers that it's illegal for you to exercise your First Amendment right of freedom of religion. Never in the history of this country have we been told that you can't go to church because it's not essential, but you can go get an abortion because that's essential. Never before in our country have we let criminals out of jail, but we've told you you can't exercise your Second Amendment right and protect yourself by purchasing a firearm. When liquor stores are deemed essential, but your businesses are deemed non-essential, there's something wrong going on.
We cut off people's utilities this week and made them pay what could have been their last check to us to turn their lights on in a global health pandemic. But you don't care about that. You didn't want to meet.
This booklet, the Declaration of Independence and our U.S. Constitution, was never designed to restrain the people. It was designed to restrain the government. We're realizing that the fatality rate of this virus is in the ballpark of a bad seasonal influenza. Do not let your voices be silenced. We will see eventually that this government-imposed cure is going to be worse than the virus itself.
Stop, help man, this shit ain't right, bro.
But what's happening now is unemployment reaches 20 to 30 million people, is those folks are now becoming dependent on the government. And what government dependency causes is a larger, more tyrannical government.
Look, look, look. He ain't even even do nothing. He ain't even do nothing. He ain't even do nothing. Look. He ain't even do nothing.
We the people want to put our government back in its place. We want a small representative government, not a large tyrannical government. I'm here representing thousands of physicians around the country whose voices must be heard.
We've never seen where we quarantine the healthy, where you take those without disease and without symptoms and lock them in your home.
So you guys are asking me to leave the store for not wearing a mask when I have a medical condition, even though yours is pulled under your nose.
There's a note that says,
I don't have to bring a note, and yours isn't even on.
You just do whatever you want to do.
It's America, right?
Listen.
I cannot wear a mask.
Get out.
Do not let your voices be silenced.